gluten, I get some diarrhea, I'm just going to cut out gluten. But actually, what's happened is that they've got something more serious underlying that they need to see a doctor about. And trying to kind of cut things out and manage it themselves can mean that you miss a more serious diagnosis. And intolerance is not a problem, but it's always the last thing that we will diagnose after ruling out the serious things.
Is it possible that more and more people are actually developing intolerances, or are we becoming more aware of possibilities?
Yeah, we know that food allergies have increased dramatically over the last couple of decades, and that's multiple reasons, due to immune exposure, different habits, and also better diagnosis. We were probably pretty bad at diagnosing certain allergies previously, but it is certainly more common.
Well, Rachel Ward, thank you very much for joining us and clarifying a lot of that, especially between food intolerances and allergies. But thank you very much, Rachel Ward, GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. I am Dom Jolly, and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, Sharon Graham has written in the Times that Keir Starmer's days in Number 10 are numbered in a warning to his would-be successors. We'll be speaking to Starmer's former political director to get his response. And we'll be looking back on a dramatic year in politics with the Times' Aubrey Allegretti. But first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. All Eurostar services to and from London have been cancelled after major disruption in the Channel Tunnel. No car or passenger trains are going through the tunnel. Queues of around 3 hours are being reported at road terminals in Folkestone and Calais. Cathy Adams is Senior Commissioning Editor for Travel at the Times and gave this update.
What we know so far, there's been a power outage in the Channel Tunnel. It's affecting Eurostar services, it's affecting Le Shuttle services, which is that car train going through. Nothing is going in or out from the French or the English side. Eurostar has said today that it's cancelled all services for the rest of the day while they're looking at trying to get it sorted. It's also affecting services on the continent. So Eurostar has services between, say, Amsterdam, Brussels and Paris. Yeah. They are also, I think, delayed and cancelled.
A Eurostar spokesperson said in the last few minutes a broken down Le Shuttle train has been moved out of the tunnel. The operator says services should gradually resume this afternoon. Meanwhile, ferry operators running between Dover and Calais have said they have capacity for extra passengers looking for alternative routes. Donald Trump says he wants to move quickly to phase two of the Gaza peace plan, warning Hamas will face consequences if it doesn't disarm. He's been holding talks in Florida with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Eli Piesch is Director of International Relations at the Israel Security and Defense Forum.
The hope is that both Israel, the U.S., the greater international community, the Western world, who is opposed to jihadism, frankly, is the target of jihadism, should see this as a perfect case study on how you could take and undo jihadism and give hope to Muslims who want to live peacefully and in a constructive way side by side with Israel.
Ukrainian officials are warning allies to ignore Russia's accusation that Kyiv launched a drone strike on Vladimir Putin's home. They say the Kremlin's provided no proof that such an attack even took place. President Trump has said he was very angry to hear the reports. Former CNN Europe editor Nina DeSantos says a lot is unclear.
It could be very much in keeping with the kind of sabotage operations that we've seen over the last couple of weeks. Remember that there was a lieutenant general who was killed in a car bomb in Moscow. And so this would be in keeping with the type of sort of tandem diplomacy that you have on the one hand with President Zelensky going to Mar-a-Lago, but at the same time, these attacks that are deniable and also these very big overt attacks that are fatal are still happening.
Former boxing champions Amir Khan and Vladimir Klitschko says they're saddened after Anthony Joshua was involved in a car crash in Nigeria yesterday. The British heavyweight is recovering in hospital. Two of his close friends died in the collision. The Cabinet Office has blamed an administrative error for journalists being shown documents about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's trade missions. Minutes from meetings 2 decades ago were redacted before being made public. And Serena Wiegmann says she never expected the respect and warmth shown by English fans after being made an honorary dame in the New Year's honours list. It's after her Lionesses side won back-to-back women's Euros. Actor Idris Elba and TV writer Roy Clark are now Sirs. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello and welcome back. This is Dom Jolly filling in for Jane and Fee until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up this hour, we'll chat about Sharon Graham's piece in the Times, look back at the past year in politics and find out the best films of 2025. I did ask you at the top of the last hour, I've handed over my family home to my son for a New Year's Eve party while we're up in London, and I'm just wondering whether that might be a mistake. So let me know. I don't know if I want to know these, but just let me know your nightmare stories, your risky business stories, basically, of leaving your kids alone in your house while you've gone away. I kind of know all the things that can go wrong. It goes up on a website. I saw this amazing documentary about someone in Holland who'd posted that they were having a party, and it was somebody's 17th, and it was supposed to be for 40 people. And this was early Facebook years, and I think instead of just posting to her friends, she put it public. And basically, long and short of it, 70,000 people, if I remember rightly, turned up in this very small Dutch town and had a riot. So Cheltenham, I'm warning you, that's all. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think, I'm sure it's not going to happen anyway. We've had a couple of texts about people responding to that talk on GPs. Honestly, this is from Frank. You asked a question, what got us to this position? The answer is clear as the nose on your face. Well, that's clear. It's total management incompetence. It is certainly not, and I repeat, not lack of resources. Another one from Derek. Hi, Dom. The cause of long waiting times for a GP appointment. According to the website of our local GP practice, there are 9 part-time GPs and 1 locum. Their average salary is almost £67,000. I suggest if they were all full-time, the problem would be solved, if only everything was that easy. But as I said, don't forget to send in your party horror stories. You can WhatsApp me on 0333 003 2353. You can text 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. Just so you know, the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. Number 3 is the New Year's Honours List that we've talked about, 2026, recognition for leaders in the culture war. Hilary McGrady of the National Trust and Police Chief John Robbins join Idris Elba, Torvalin Dean and Cynthia Erivo on this year's list of more than 1,000 names approved by King Charles. Of course, what we really want to know is who wasn't approved. The second most read story is Anthony Joshua inches from death as Nigeria car crash kills 2 friends. The British boxer was injured when his SUV he was travelling in collided with a stationary truck, killing his strength coach and personal trainer. And the most read piece on the Times website is George Clooney hails French privacy laws as couple become citizens. The Oscar-winning actor has previously expressed his fondness for France, but admitted to struggling with the language ahead of becoming citizens by an official decree. So there you go. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, well, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, Unite's Sharon Graham says it's inevitable that Keir Starmer will be replaced as Labour leader. And writing in the Times, the union leader says the government risks sowing the seeds of its own destruction if Starmer's successor in Number 10 doesn't depart from its current path. Graham was the only union leader not to endorse Labour's election-winning manifesto. So joining us now is Luke Sullivan, Keir Starmer's former political director. Luke, thanks for joining me. How concerned should Keir Starmer be about this piece by Sharon Graham?
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me. I mean, I think I was thinking back to where I am currently, and I'm at my in-laws in Northumberland, where I tend to go for Christmas and Easter. And it tends to be that Sharon makes these interventions around the Labour Party and often criticism of Keir Starmer at these big holidays because they're breaks in the media coverage. And I think in terms of his concern and Number 10's concern, I think they will brush it off and not really worry that much. But I do think within the piece, which is, you know, an interesting argument about the future direction of the Labour Party, there are some things that she says, and I think there are some lessons for the government. And I think principally, many of the things that Sharon is arguing this government should do, I would say they are doing or have said they're going to do. And I think this has been part of the problem of the first 18 months that, you know, people like Sharon, who do follow closely what the government are doing, aren't necessarily hearing, and the government need to get on and actually deliver on the things that they've said they're going to do.
But don't you think that if someone like her, who is very closely following what the government's doing, is not impressed, I mean, how is anyone else going to be? I mean, apart from anything else, it's not just a comms problem, is it? I mean, she said that Starmer's exit from Number 10 is inevitable. And don't you think this expresses how a lot of people are feeling about the Prime Minister?
I'd take on that point about inevitability. I think it's fair to say, and I think Sharon has written a piece in which she knows the headline and the top line is going to be this statement about the Prime Minister's future. She's right to say that there is a lot of question marks over the future direction of this government. But my analysis of why that is the case is that ultimately the Labour Party for the last 18 months have been sort of at 20% in the polls, and people are questioning whether the government are able to get re-elected. I think a lot of the troubles that this government have had wouldn't necessarily be any better if there was another leader there. And that's where I would agree with Sharon. And I think what this government has to focus on, it has got itself in this problem where the Labour Party, sadly, is focused more on the inner workings and the leadership of the Labour Party rather than getting on and focusing on doing the job at hand, which is delivering against that manifesto.
But you agreed there that there was an inevitability about it. I mean, can Keir Starmer turn this around, or, you know, is she right? Are his days numbered?
I think it is absolutely in his hands. I am not a fatalist. I don't think anything is inevitable. I think politicians go in and have a lot of levers at their control. I think one of the things I would say to the Prime Minister and this Labour government is they're in power. Yes, reform, and everybody is looking through the prism of where reform and other parties such as the Greens are. But actually, this government's in power. It's got a big working majority. It's got more than 3 years until the next big set of general election. And it's got the ability to get on and turn round the political mood music. And I think hopefully what we are going to see in the new year is the Prime Minister's going to focus much more on some of the issues that have mattered or matter to the British public, such as the cost of living. And, you know, I am hopeful that the Prime Minister and this Labour government can turn it round, because I do think everything's to play for.
Unite have become more and more estranged from Labour over the years. Is this a relationship that the party just can't afford to lose?
I, in my old life, when I used to work for Keir Starmer, one of a big part of my job was to help manage the relationship with the trade unions. And I think all Labour leaders from the very inception of the Labour Party have always had to put a lot of effort and time into working with the trade unions. I think, you know, as ever, we're in a new modern context, and those challenges, you know, whilst very familiar, are different because of the modern context we're working in. And I think that unite and the link with the affiliated trade unions is really important to the Labour Party. And I think what I would hope was that, you know, rather than the Labour government and Unite and the affiliated unions, you know, writing letters to each other through the pages of the Times, you know, regardless how good a newspaper it is, that they have these conversations in private. You know, there's a lot that they can, you know, working together achieve. And I do think this Labour government is making achievements for Unite members and trade union members.
They should stop doing it while you're with your in-laws, you think, up in Northumberland. It's just not right. Sharon Graham, not only thinking it's inevitable that Keir Starmer will go, but not that excited about any of the supposed successors. How do you think the potential successors to Keir Starmer will respond to the piece?
My suspicion is most people will just put this down to, you know, a story that was between Christmas and New Year and won't seek to engage in it. But I do think, as Patrick Maguire in the piece in the Times, with which is the sort of the news story accompanying it, makes the point, and I think it's in the question you've just asked, which is Unite have been, especially under the leadership of Sharon Graham, more detached from the sort of day-to-day workings of the Labour Party. I think part of that was Sharon's desire to be different from what went before, where Len McCluskey was much more interested in the inner workings of it. But I do think that all Labour politicians, on the whole, recognise the value of working with trade unions and having that relationship. I think, you know, most of them, as I've said, aren't going to engage in this. But, you know, the point that Unite didn't get involved in the deputy leadership election that we had towards the end of the year to replace Angela was quite an interesting point, that they do seem a bit detached from, you know, some of the, you know, the potential future leadership candidates of the Labour Party, which is odd for Unite.
I think that's putting it mildly. But Luke Sullivan, Keir Starmer's former political director, thank you very much for joining us from your in-laws in Northumberland. Coming up, we'll look back on the last year in politics. It is 2:14, and you're listening to Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
It's the last breakfast show of 2025 with Rosie Wright and Jane Mulkerins. We're sitting in for Kate McCann and Stig Abel, and we're going to look back at the funniest political moments of the year with the Times sketchwriter Tom Peck. And our panel, it's A-List. It's Edwina Curry and A.N. Wilson to help us go through the news of the day and of the year. See you tomorrow from 6.
Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open-seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
It might be mid-winter, but there's nothing mid about this offer. The new Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra brings every winter sport moment to life as crisp as freshly laid snow. With its stunning 6.9-inch dynamic AMOLED display, razor-sharp resolution. But here's the real win. Claim £250 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. This is Times Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Dom Jolly, on Times Radio. It's been a dramatic year in politics, both at home and abroad.
Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning. I know. You're not winning this.
She looks absolutely miserable. Labour MPs, they can point as much as they like. The fact is, Labour MPs are going on the record saying that the Chancellor is toast.
With us, you start having
cards. Playing cards.
Right now, you don't
have
you're playing cards.
Mr. President.
You're playing cards.
Serious.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
From the Oval Office showdown between Presidents Trump and Zelensky to a Chancellor in tears in the House of Commons, we've seen new parties launched, reform on the rise, and Keir Starmer fighting off potential usurpers. There's been the advance of Zach Polanski's Greens and the unexpected return of Liz Truss via YouTube.
Welcome to the first ever edition of the Liz Truss Show. You'd have to be watching the fake news BBC or living on Elon Musk's Mars mission to not know that Britain is going to hell in a handcart.
To help us out of this handcart and unpick it all, I'm joined now by Aubrey Allegretti, Chief Political Correspondent at The Times. Aubrey, thanks for joining me. Take me through them. What are your top political moments of the year?
Oh, it's been an absolute roller coaster, hasn't it? And I mean, for Keir Starmer, it started really with his attempt at a recess in January, refreshing elements of his number 10 team, changing his director of communications, and trying to put behind him a really difficult winter and a turbulent sort of first 4 or 5 months in office. They had sort of some successes, the government, and can sort of claim that they've moved with relatively swift pace through the first parliamentary session, which is supposed to come to an end next spring. But obviously they did face major rebellions over issues like the welfare vote, and it's really created quite a difficult dynamic in the parliamentary Labour Party for Keir Starmer, who's now, I think, going into 2026, struggling to exert his authority somewhat.
Sharon Graham, General Secretary of Unite, said it's inevitable he'll be replaced. Do you think he'll last the year, and who might replace him?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably underpriced that actually Keir Starmer is in a relatively strong position, not least because the rules for changing Labour leader are different from the ones for the Conservative Party. Under the Conservatives, you only needed 10% of people to effectively say that they had no confidence in the current leader in order to force a contest. Under Labour, you effectively need about a quarter of the parliamentary party to go on the record, put their names forward and unify around a single alternative candidate, which means that I actually think Keir Starmer is relatively secure in his position going into 2026. What that doesn't mean, though, is that MPs are happy and won't be trying to sort of snipe from the sidelines to destabilise him. And there is going to come a real crunch point in May next year, just after the local elections and, of course, the elections in Scotland and Wales, where there risks being a real bitter, open feud between Keir Starmer and his allies in number 10 and those who want to see him out because they think that ultimately he is dragging the Labour Party further and further down in the polls to its certain demise at the next election.
Let's dig down a little bit to some of the big moments of the year. I mean, the one we just heard a clip from it there, and it really was shocking when it happened, the Oval Office showdown between Trump and Zelensky.
It certainly was. I mean, I remember watching it from the UK side, and it was almost the sort of worst of all world scenario, because Keir Starmer was quite sort of triumphantly trying to keep up relations between Ukraine and the US. But here we had a meeting that almost certainly should have been taking place behind closed doors, although I suppose as a journalist, there's a vested interest in suggesting that actually it was quite very helpful to be able to see the dynamics at play publicly. But it seemed to be this sort of public ritual show of humiliation in which the president and vice president were obviously subjecting Zelensky to their views and verdicts on his time as the Ukrainian president and his sort of stance. And it really kind of gave Russia a lot of leverage that I think put Ukraine a lot more on the sort of diplomatic back foot for the remainder of the year. So although, you know, they sort of kissed and made up, as it were, later, it hasn't proved to be a very fruitful moment for those relations. And it really came to typify the extent to which actually the US was getting increasingly frustrated and fed up with Ukraine.
I mean, it was just incredibly uncomfortable to watch. It was sort of visceral and bullying, and it felt terrible. I haven't followed Zelensky's sartorial. Did he start wearing a suit, or did he steadfastly refuse to?
I'm pretty sure on the next occasion they met that he was wearing more formal attire. I'm not sure.
He put a jacket over the T-shirt, I think, not the full suit.
Yeah, exactly. It was a sort of sop to Donald Trump, but without kind of going full, sort of acquiescing to everything that he would have demanded. So, yeah, it's proved a really turbulent relationship. And actually, over the last few days, obviously, Zelensky and Trump have been meeting again. Keir Starmer and other Western leaders convened this kind of big call between all of them. So sometimes Keir Starmer's been sort of using himself as a kind of human shield for Zelensky because he has a better relationship with Donald Trump. And that means that he can somewhat protect the Ukrainian leader.
Talk to us about Rachel Reeves being in tears during Prime Minister's questions.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I mean, I remember being stood just behind the Commons Chamber at the time when MPs in the chamber were texting me and saying, we've just seen the Chancellor leave in tears. And of course, it was this incredible moment where she had left the chamber. And so she'd already been seen in public. And that was why her team felt that she needed to go back in, because if she'd sort of disappeared, then there would have been even greater questions about the security of her job. It was obviously in the run-up to a really sort of difficult climb down on the welfare decision. So initially, the government had been looking to cut between £5.5 billion from the welfare budget as part of big swingeing reforms, particularly aimed at curbing the rise of disability benefits. And the Chancellor was rumoured to have said to the Speaker afterwards, I'm just under so much pressure. And it seemed as though her team thought that she would be able to hold it together when she went back into the Commons. But immediately it was clear that she had been crying. She'd been sort of escorted out by her sister, Ellie Reeves, who was also in the government. I think she was Labour Party chair at the time. And the pair of them had this sort of heart to heart in a room just next to the Commons chamber, thinking that she would be able to hold it together when she went back in. But of course, it was really, really difficult and quite unsettling and uncomfortable to watch. But obviously it did partly secure her status as the Chancellor that can't be moved to sort of butcherize a script song, because the market seemed so worried by the prospect of her going that actually it did sort of solidify and cement her position.
And then the last year's very much been sort of for the non-mainstream parties, if you like, although, you know, Reform are becoming pretty mainstream now. I mean, let's talk about some of those. Let's talk about the rise of the Reform Party in the last year.
Yeah, certainly. So I think we all sort of take for granted that they've been sailing high since the election. Whereas in actual fact, looking back to July 2024, I mean, they were polling about 15, 16%. So they have literally more or less doubled what they were on since then. There's been a slight peaking of that trend at around sort of 31, 32%. And actually in the last couple of weeks, we've started to see them slow down, that average sort of slowly start to come down to the sort of 30% mark, in some cases, the high 20s. And that's being taken as an indication by some people that Reform has a ceiling, that there are many more people that dislike strongly Nigel Farage, who would be willing to vote tactically against him, both in the elections next year and at a general election, when it's very much sort of the question will be framed by Labour as a choice between Nigel Farage and Keir Starmer, or between, in Labour's perspective, the extremists versus the progressives. And so whether or not Nigel Farage can maintain the momentum that he's shown over the last 18 months, I think, is going to be very difficult for them, particularly as they're scrutinised more heavily over the extent to which they are actually in power and governing. They obviously run about a dozen councils. They've got two metro mayoralties, and they would be in contention to be potentially winning power in Cardiff in May. Now, the voting system and the electoral system probably make that very hard for them, but they definitely stand a chance of coming first or second place in terms of vote share, possibly seats. Plaid Cymru are tipped to do better than them. But there is a sort of real track record now that people are starting to point to, whether that's how much they're actually raising council tax by, despite pledging to sort of keep those rises as limited as possible, or other things like whether Reform is getting slightly too obsessed with the accusations of culture wars, like the issue of flags and DEI, trying to sort of reduce titles in people's roles. People are sort of obviously very concerned about the cost of living, and it feels as though the Reform is being increasingly judged on its performance in power.
And then the emergence of Corbyn's Your Party, which was often maligned in a sort of Monty Python reference slightly. How did that go overall?
Yeah, I mean, they've had a much less successful, well, I say start, but obviously they kind of launched in summer last year. So the fact that we are nearly 6-7 months hence, and yet they seem to still be on the back foot with a huge split between Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana over the sort of who should be the face and the future of the party. Jeremy Corbyn, on the one hand, a very experienced politician who thinks that he has the team around him to be able to kind of lead the party, and Zara Sultana, who sees herself as this kind of young, thrusting MP that wants to be the future face of the sort of progressive cause on the left. That tension has really sort of boiled over. And it seems as though Zara Sultana's kind of been losing allies. Those people who had joined with her to sit on the board of directors of the Your Party group that she was running they all sort of quit. And so it seems like they're going into 2026 quite disunited. They should be in quite a strong position to field a slate of candidates. National elections are a really perfect sort of launch pad. And of course, there are elections in places like Birmingham in 2026 in May, which is exactly the sort of area where a party that's explicitly sort of pro-Gaza is expected to do quite well. Labour had traditionally dominated there. It's obviously been on the back foot over the very long-running bin strike. So there will be a real sort of test for the Your Party movement in May, but it's not quite clear that they're up to the challenge.
And I think the most surprising or unexpected political story for me was Zach Polanski, the rising, you know, the real rise in popularity of the Green Party.
Certainly, and that's translated both in terms of vote share in the opinion polls. It's really interesting to see how much it climbs at a sort of 45, 50 degree angle in the polls the moment at which Zach Polanski becomes leader. And I think it marks a real significant departure from the Greens' previous electoral strategy, which seemed to be playing things sort of softly, softly, trying to gradually grow their support in a handful of areas in the hope that in a first-past-the-post system, that would be the most effective way to avoid sort of spreading your bets and getting nowhere. I think Zach Polanski represents a very different political campaigning strategy, which is probably more akin to what Jeremy Corbyn saw. And of course, the Greens have done very well in elections past. They often get millions of votes. The problem is that those don't translate into seats because of the electoral system we have. And so I think Zach Polanski represents this much more kind of mass movement, which is founded on rallies, trying to win votes in as many places as possible. The risk of that is, of course, that you spread yourself too thin and you are putting resources into too many places and failing to get over the bar in enough of them. The Greens obviously did very well at the last election, getting more MPs than they ever had before. So the question will be, again, whether or not they can really break through in a first-past-the-post system. They're expected to do particularly well in London, which has elections next year. So that will be the key target for them.
And finally, just very, very briefly, just one prediction for next year, something extraordinary.
I think it's underpriced that Keir Starmer remains Prime Minister until the end of the year. I think there is genuinely there is a big groundswell of a push against him, but I still think that the rebels are disorganised enough that he could squeak through and make the argument that actually disunity and the threat of having to call a general election because of a new leader will be enough to put the rebels at bay.
You heard it there first. Let's get to the bookies. Aubrey Allegretti, thank you so much. They're chief political correspondent at The Times. Coming up, film critic Jason Solomons is on hand with me to tell us about the best films of 2025. That's all after the news with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The broken down Le Shuttle train has been moved from the Channel Tunnel, but all London to Europe Eurostar services have been cancelled for the day. The operator said no passengers are stranded inside the tunnel after a power failure caused its closure. It had said services will gradually resume this afternoon. Times Radio's James Kitchen has more.
So this is apparently because of a problem with the overhead power supply, but at the moment telling passengers not to travel. And we've already seen pictures on social media of some very confused looking passengers at St Pancras. Already huge backlogs there of people who can't board their trains.
National Highways has warned there are severe delays on routes to the Port of Dover and Folkestone. Meanwhile, ferry operators running between Dover and Calais have said they have capacity for extra passengers looking for alternative routes. Those close to two members of boxer Anthony Joshua's Inner Circle who died in a road crash in Nigeria have been remembering their friends. Sina Gami and Latif Ayodele died when the car they were travelling in hit a parked truck yesterday. Idris Elba is becoming a Sir. The Luther star is one of those named in the New Year honours list for his services to young people. Three-time London Marathon winner Paula Radcliffe gets an OBE. The government's denied that redacted files released to the National Archives are part of a cover-up. There's been criticism that minutes of a meeting relating to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor have been censored. And heatwaves and mild weather have hit Octopus Energy Group's profits this year. The firm, which runs Britain's biggest electricity and gas supplier, says its earnings have slumped by over £100 million. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Hobby cats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
The biggest Furniture Village sale of the year is on now. And it's everything you've been waiting for. But hurry, our early bird offers end soon.
Right, brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op, owned by you, right by you.
Ends 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op Group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast. 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome back. This is me, Dom Jolly, with you till 4 p.m. But then after 4 p.m, we have Drive with Ollie Mann, and he's here in the studio.
The highlight.
The highlight. This is. I'm just warming up for Ollie Mann here.
What a privilege.
Yesterday we had Crackergate. What are you going to talk to me about today?
Well, I'm actually nervous to mention this to you because you said yesterday that you don't like musicals.
So I hate musicals. Yeah. I was trying to be polite to the person I was interviewing about that musical.
Actively
I just
detest.
Do, yeah.
You one couldn't, of the things
you're
I love.
Not one of these people that
I am.
You say, oh, but you haven't seen the right one.
Totally that person.
You're a groomer. You'd take me to musicals and tell me which one I should like. Which one would you take me to?
Which one would I take you to? Oh, my goodness.
Because the Book of Mormon's the one they always go on about.
Right, yeah,
and I went to see it, and I understand what's funny about it. I just know.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what I don't get.
Yeah.
Even if there's a really good story, which is important.
Yes.
Suddenly, like, you're watching it all, and then suddenly everyone starts singing. And you're like, hang on, why is no one addressing that they're singing here?
So then you want sung through as a style. Sort of
light
opera.
What's that? I'd say,
well, it sounds, like Les Miserables or Sunset Boulevard, where there's hardly any dialogue. It's just straight through. Everyone's singing all the time.
That's even worse. I think it's the singing I object to.
Anyway,
yeah,
I'm nervous to even mention the word. How do you feel about Disney? That was my, you know, because if you don't like musicals.
Well, I mean, Jungle Book is, I think, my all-time favourite film of
musical.
All time.
That's a musical.
Yes, it is.
Mary Poppins is a musical.
And it's great music
right.
as well.
Right, yeah. Okay. I think I found the chink in the armour.
But I'm watching that on a screen. I'm not sitting somewhere. I don't know.
Right, okay.
It's that sort of heightened stuff.
Well, you may be interested in this from your travel writing hat on, actually, because the reason I mention it is there's a piece on the Times website today by our US West Coast editor talking about the price of a Disney World holiday these days.
Yeah.
It is now. It is actually staggering when you look at the figures. For an American family, because Brits get deals, don't we, when we go to these places? But for an American family, to take a family of four to Orlando for the day,
right?
$2,161.
What?
Before you pay for your food and your queue jumping and your special experiences with Mickey and all the rest of it.
I mean, that whole Disney World thing is a bit like an app, isn't it? In-app purchases. Once you're in there, there's lots of
stuff. There's premium stuff.
I'd pay $2,000 not to go.
Yeah, you see, this is what I worried about.
Oh, come on.
I thought you'd be on this. I'm on Team Disney.
No,
I
went to Euro Disney once.
It's called Disneyland Paris these days, Tom. Come on.
Well, it was Euro Disney. That's how old I am. And I went with my then-girlfriend. We broke up 3 days afterwards. She made me go, and we sat on Small World or whatever it's called. We had to go round.
It's a Small World.
It's
one
a small
of the iconic
world.
Rides of all time.
One of the worst experiences of my life.
Yeah.
And we went round four times, and I remember thinking, we're going to break up when I leave here.
Well, anyway, we'll be talking about what's a reasonable price for a premium experience like that.
£4.
I don't think you can get anything in Disney World for £4.
Okay.
Maybe.
You don't genuinely like... I understand if you're taking kids to
Disney... I was taking kids. I've been this year, yes.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
Yeah.
And I understand
no,
they
I do
get
genuinely
excited.
Love it, yes.
Although even I feel a bit... if my kids had wanted to go there, I would have been disappointed in my children, but I would have done it. But people that go with no children,
yeah.
Sorry,
no. I went for 3 weeks, most expensive holiday I've ever had.
You went for three
this
weeks,
Easter. You're not just to Disney World, to Orlando.
Oh, just going round and round. It's a small world.
But 10 days of my 20-day holiday this year, which was a massive blowout, biggest holiday we've ever had as a family.
Apparently,
was
we're going to start
Park,
wrapping up. Really?
Okay, all right. So I did this yesterday. We had a light conversation.
Well, what's happening on your show? You're just going to tell people about your 20-day holiday in Disneyland.
We're going to talk about whether it's gone too far.
far and whether they need to focus. Because it's all against Uncle Walt's vision for what a theme park should
be.
Can
I tell you my favourite story about Disneyland? Because you interrupted me yesterday. And I'm going to tell you a story. Yeah. My favourite was a French character smuggled himself into Euro Disney, as it was, as a Smurf, who is a non-Disney...
Oh, no, that's totally non-canon.
Non-Disney character. Yeah. And he was frog-marched out by Disney security. And there's fantastic
footage...
By Kermit,
surely, if you're being frog-marched.
I don't know. But there's fantastic footage of a Smurf being hurled out of Disney, Euro Disney. That's what I want to see.
We'll also be talking about Venezuela, Dom. I did this yesterday when I mentioned China-Taiwan. Serious story as well.
Now, Venezuela, I want to go to, not Euro Disney. Yeah. Somewhere I haven't been, I really want to go.
Well, there's a Venn diagram there because I like Disney World and I would also like to go to Venezuela.
So we could holiday together. Yeah.
But yes, Trump's attacked it again. Well, the CIA have. What's he up to? Is it just his personal vendetta against Maduro, or is it even legal for him to do that? We only know because he's gone and told the world that he's done it. Normally the CIA ops don't get told about. But yes, we'll be discussing that as well.
I'm being told to wrap up. I'm just useless at highlighting your show, aren't I?
No, I think you've done a great job.
I'm trying to kibosh it, I think, but there you go.
It's anyway, a small I've world got after all.
Look, I really look forward to it, and I will listen to it all and enjoy it. Have a good drive time. That was Ollie Mann coming up after me. Not long now, don't worry. The boss of the Everyman cinema chain has stepped down less than 3 weeks after the firm cut its forecasts for revenue and earnings. Yet with films like Marty Supreme, Sinners and The Brutalist, many are calling 2025 the year that got movie lovers back in their seats. I've been speaking to Jason Solomons, critic turned film producer, about the top pictures of 2025. And we began by discussing Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another.
It's certainly on my list. It's very near the top of the list. I sometimes kind of go, should I pick a number one? Should it be an arty one that no one's heard of? Or should it be a mainstream one? Look, One Battle After Another is the film that got people moving out of their seats to the cinema. And that's, you know, people like you and me that are genuine fans. It's got Leonardo DiCaprio. Fantastic. He's brilliant in it. I think it's one of his best and more likable performances. He's lived in. He plays this kind of revolutionary who's sort of seen better days and is now just getting stoned and can't remember how to recontact his revolutionary cell, can't remember the password for the phones, which is very now because I can't remember any of my passwords. And he's trying to reconnect with his daughter, who's trying to find her mother. Then there's Sean Penn, who's on this murderous kind of war path. It's a mix of genres, very hard to describe. It's by Paul Thomas Anderson, who is probably, you know, one of the great living filmmakers. You've got Tarantino, you've got Scorsese, you've got Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, he did Boogie Nights and he did Magnolia and he did The Master and There Will Be Blood, of course. So he's always someone to contend with, and it's sort of muscular American filmmaking. There's car chases, there's shootouts, there's sex, there's madness in it. And it's all sometimes a comedy, and then sometimes it's a tragedy, and then sometimes it's an action film. So it's got a lot in there. There's bits with Benicio del Toro turns up, and that's a real, you know, fast action sequence where they're running through the corridors and running away from stuff and escaping. So I thought it was brilliant and surprising and did all those things that you need to go to the cinema for. It was big, it had great music. Again, that score from Johnny Greenwood is brilliant. So, it's top cinema, to be honest. Very good choice, Tom Johnny.
It's weird, though, because I went... And I enjoyed it. I thought it was a little bit too long, if I'm honest.
It is long, yeah.
But that's fine. But my main thing was I just love that sort of film gets made, because I'm so anti-superhero franchises and all those things that I've just had no interest in. And I've been watching a lot of 70s cinema, actually, just going back to kind of classic, I don't know, Serpico I watched the other day and stuff. Why did we make such incredible films in the 70s? Or am I just, is it boomer talk? Am I just getting old and
right, boomer. to which I say 6-7, Dom. I think we did lose a lot of audiences with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I do think people went, you know what, we love our comic books and Spider-Man and all that, but not exhaustively, not to 30.
Only when I was 11 years old,
exactly.
Not now.
Yeah. Exactly. The infantilization of mainstream cinema was a massive problem for many people. I was a sort of well-known critic at those times, and I was just, my heart sank every time. Of course, we love 70s cinema. We love Coppola. We love Scorsese in their young pop, when the Mavericks ruled, when Spielberg was coming out with Duel and Jaws.
I just watched Duel. Oh, I've forgotten how great Duel was.
What is amazing. Although that was originally made for TV, strangely enough.
Was it?
Yeah. And it was sort of only later when it, you know, they realised it was cinematic, and it's only two, you know, it's just a car and a truck chasing each other.
It's incredible, though.
But that definitely comes into Paul Thomas Anderson's film, that sequence on the race. That's June, you know.
My wife gets very bad travel sickness, and that bit where they're going up and down, that really, really finished it. But look, I'm conscious that I'm not really supposed to be talking about the state of cinema.
We are, because that's what we do. We look at the year and sort of say, well, was it a good year? Was it a year to save cinema?
Was it a good year?
Well, I think if you always think, oh God, no, it's a terrible year because, you know, Netflix bought Warner Brothers, and they, you know, that's just the kind of duel. That's the shark eating up the you know, the classics. But is it though? I think if you look hard enough. And that's what the job of a curator or a critic is to do, to point you to stuff that is extraordinary and is something you haven't seen before and does hark back to those films that you loved and does. And they are there, and they've got those bumpy edges and those rough things, and perhaps not the stars that you know, and they're not wearing tights. You know, that's
100%. So you sent me a little list of the ones that you were going to talk about. So can I mention the three that I've seen and we discuss, and then you can recommend some that I probably wouldn't see.
Yeah.
So obviously, first one I saw was One Battle After Another, which definitely worth seeing. Just extraordinary filmmaking. The second one I actually watched last night, and I'd been meaning to watch it for ages, The Ballad of Wallace Island. I loved it. It was so sweet and sort of darkly funny. If I had one thing, I felt Tim Key slightly channeling David Brent at moments. But apart from that, I just thought, what a great film.
Yeah, good choice. It is one of my choices because it steals up on you. It was actually based on a short that Tim Key and Tom Basden made like 10 years ago, and they decided eventually to kind of build it out. So it's about a lottery winner who's a recluse who lives on an island off the coast of Wales, and he has got a lot of money, so he can invite his favourite band to come and play on his island, and he lures them by making them think that they are going to play to a sizable concert, and it turns out it's just going to be for him. And in fact, that band has split up, and so the key guitarist, they're a sort of folk duo who had some success, and Tom Basden comes back and he gets them to reunite, and the female vocalist in the band is played by Kerry Mulligan, who's always good and is excellent in this. And it's a comedy of loneliness and connection, and can money buy you stuff? There's some hilarious bits in it that are brilliantly situationist, like he's really good at serving at tennis. He's got a tennis court in his garden.
He's
great at serving, but because he's a recluse, he's had no one return his serve.
He's learned to serve for 6 years, but he's never returned a serve. What I love, there's a shop on the island, and the woman who runs the shop, I thought, I know you from somewhere. And I realised she's the grumpy sister from Fleabag.
Yes.
I thought she was great.
Sean Lloyd, It's very funny, but it does build. What's good about it is that Tim Key performance, it does build. You know, he does all the Tim Key stuff, and we love him for it, but it does build into a sort of meditation on love, and we want to know why he wants to get that band together, and it's because, you know, it's something to do with his ex-wife, and so there's a plangency and a melancholy that it kind of comes over, but suits the music and suits the way it's shot. It's very simple and fussy, but I think it steals your heart away. It's a gorgeous little British film.
I watched it with my wife, and she's an even tougher audience than me. We both just loved it. And yeah, it was just, he was great. I mean, you really felt for him at the end. So yeah, I think it's brilliant. So well done them. The third one that I've seen on your list is A House of Dynamite. I loved this.
Yeah, this is Catherine Bigelow, of course, who won the Oscar for Hurt Locker. She's the kind of the ballsy female filmmaker. She was married to James Cameron, of course, in there, but she's done fantastic things like Point Break. She looks at male behaviour and machismo, and she does Zero Dark Thirty. She's very good on... She doesn't do rom-coms, let's put it that way. She does a lot of heavy army military stuff, and this is about a loose nuke. It's about a nuclear warhead that's heading towards Chicago, and the American defense system is supposed to stop it, but for some reason it doesn't seem to be working. They don't know where this nuke has come from. So we get all the situational rooms. We get the kind of chief ops room. We get the president, who's played by Idris Elba. And they all get their sort of little vignettes, and it comes together as a jigsaw. But there's a lot of people looking at the screen frantically. It's a lot of people on their mobile phones going, oh, my God!
I mean, it could have been like a documentary on air traffic control, but it was much, much more interesting than that. And you see the same scenario played out through sort of three or four different people's viewpoints, and it builds to that end. Now, some people a little bit disappointed at the ending,
But what can you do, really? I mean,
it's not a pretty scenario, to be honest. I mean, I've got to say, I didn't know about this defence system and that how fragile.
I just hoped it was there. But
yeah, I just assumed someone knew what they were doing.
Someone was going to deal with it, yeah.
Turns out nobody knows what they're doing.
It was very frightening, I thought. I mean, it left me quite traumatised, actually.
Yeah, I think she does that really well. I mean, and it's the way that you sort of see different scenes unfold from a different camera angle, the sort of the perspective, what they call it, Rashomon style, after Kurosawa's Rashomon, which tells the same story from seven different perspectives.
I knew that.
There you go. But just throw that in now. Now you can entertain your New Year's Eve guests with... Yeah. It's like Rashomon in here tonight.
That's proper film chat now. I like it.
But I thought it builds to this kind of, you know, it's frantic, it's fraught. And, you know, there are some surprises still as well. And there's a lot of kind of US kind of hardware, and people are supposed to know what they're doing. You know, you trust these people. They're either trained elite operatives or they're elected representatives and they're kind of seasoned politicians. But it turns out when there's a nuclear bomb about to drop on your head, you kind of forget everything and just want to call your mum or your dad or your children. And I like that's the human aspect of that. And that's why it's called House of Dynamite. We have built this house. We have built ourselves a house of dynamite, I think is the quote, because there are lots of these nukes around and no one really knows who's got them anymore.
Tell me some things that I should see or I should look into that I wouldn't have heard of, maybe.
I would recommend at the moment Song Sung Blue, which I think is just coming out, which... I grew up on Neil Diamond. I have to say, I have memories of sitting in the back of my dad's car with his 8-track Neil Diamond tracks going on. And Song Sung Blue was like a song that we sang as a family that was like, you know, it's quite easy to sing. This film stars Hugh Jackman as a Neil Diamond tribute act and Kate Hudson, who he falls in love with, and they form a band. I thought it was going to be rubbish. It absolutely had me tapping my toes and singing with my heart out and smiling. It's a great, great musical film. And then suddenly there's a bit of tragedy that kind of completely takes you by surprise. It's a brilliant, brilliant, crowd-pleasing film. And I wouldn't be surprised if it suddenly starts getting a lot of traction in the awards season. People love Kate Hudson. And this is a great music film. It's about dreams and what music can do for you. And she was in Almost Famous, of course, one of the other great music films. Yeah. And this is sort of up there with that, except it's funny and... they're part of a sort of looky-likey gang, really, and some of those scenes are fantastic where they're all backstage with, you know, looky-likey Presley and looky-likey Buddy Holly, and they do a whole sort of show of tribute acts. Just gorgeous film, Song Sung Blue. It's the surprise, so I want to kind of alert you to it. But it's mainstream, totally mainstream, but it's one of those that will just steal hearts as it goes along.
That was film producer Jason Solomons, and we'll hear more from him after the break.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply, selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
Hi, just leaving work now. Sorry it's a bit loud. So I was thinking we could get Mackey's tonight. Had a Big Mac on my mind all day, and delivery fee on the app is now from 99p. So, you in? Of course you are. Love you. Bye.
Exclusively on the McDonald's app. 18 plus. Service fee and small order fee may apply. Participating restaurants. Serving times and T's and C's apply.
Right. Brace yourself. At Co-op, you can get two pizzas and a tub of Ben & Jerry's for a fiver. Yep, a fiver. It's kind of a big deal, eh?
You're unbelievable.
Co-op. Owned by you, right by you.
End 2nd of January. Selected products subject to availability. Co-op, Crew, Food Stores only. See co-op.co.uk for details.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
So we've been hearing from film producer Jason Solomons about whether 2025 will be known as the year that saves cinema. Dipping back in, I asked Jason whether Ryan Coogler's latest horror film, Sinners, is going to freak me out.
It doesn't start out as a horror. That's what's good about Sinners. It starts out as is Michael B. Jordan. And if you like Michael B. Jordan, which I know a lot of people do,
yeah,
there are two of him.
Right.
Not like not like Bernie Winters and Mike, you know, when they kind of said, no, there's two of them. There's great, there's two of them. Michael B. Jordan, he plays twin brothers who open up a juke joint kind of soul shack in 1930s segregated Mississippi. And they start this juke joint. And there's some brilliant sequences where they sort of do what Baz Luhrmann does, puts a bit of modern music through it. But they trace the history of jazz, blues and soul through this kind of juke joint. And it's brilliant. And then suddenly people start feeding on it. Vampires appear. Yeah. So, and you're thinking, why vampires? But then you think, well, this is kind of a Black America experience. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
And it's a good metaphor at that one. And it works. And it is a bit scary, but not too scary. And because it's a metaphor, you're always aware of the sort of the slight satirical scant of it. I thought it was brilliant. I'd never seen anything like it. I have to say, it's Ryan Coogler who did Black Panther. And this is a totally original idea, big budget, really well acted. Delroy Lindo's in it. It's got a fantastic score. And it's one of the big surprises of the year to me. And I loved it. And I would definitely recommend Sinners.
Okay, I'm going to give that a go. I think this sums up my problem with film, actually, and especially with superhero. You know, I hate the big last third of any superhero film is just the big explosive battle.
Yeah.
There was that, and it's the bit where films go crazy in the third act. There's, what was that film with Hugh Grant where the girls knock on his door?
Heretic.
I loved the first two thirds of Heretic. I thought it was so good, so incredible. And then it just goes into a gore fest explosion.
And someone just goes, oh, we got to get out of this. Yeah.
Why did they do that? And in a way, that's maybe why I like A House of Dynamite, because it never gets to that moment. It constantly builds to that and then returns and goes back. I don't know, but yeah.
No, I think it's the screenwriter's trick. You know, there's like four, sometimes the screenwriters have four endings to movies. They don't really know when to stop them. You know, should we have a poignant shock? Should we have a fight? Should we have a battle? Should we have an explosion? So I think films that don't do that and do those formulas that you can see that last third coming are much better. Sinners, I suppose, does go for that a bit, but it has earned the right to, you know, so someone's got to bring an end to this evening with these vampires.
I'm very excited. I'm going to have a go at that. Talk to me about Marty Supreme.
Yeah, that's a hell of a movie.
Because I met Matthew Saeed, who writes for the Sunday Times or the Times, and he, I met him at the Olympics in Beijing, and he was a ping pong specialist.
He was a champion, yeah.
Yeah, and he literally he was talking about that 10,000 hours thing where if you just...
It was him and four mates from Reading. Ended
that's
up
right. Kind of, and you just start doing it. So what's Marty Supreme about?
Marty Supreme is based on the life of a two-time US table tennis champion called Marty someone. And but it's just very loosely based on his life. It's set in the 50s in New York. Timothy Chalamet plays this fast talking, hustling table tennis champion who again gets kind of wants to play number one on the US team. And the Marty Supreme is in fact the table tennis, the ping pong ball he's trying to invent and market and become have a hit with the Marty Supreme.
Yeah, okay.
So there I've just explained, it's not a spoiler, I think it explains it rather well, because he's desperate on a hustle to kind of make something of himself. And this is his route. Table tennis is his route to stardom or his route to money, but it's a really rubbish route to stardom and money because no one gets famous really through table tennis. Not even Matthew Saeed is much more famous now as a brilliant writer and commentator.
So it's a suburban alternative to boxing to get you out of the hood, basically.
It's a sports movie, but you know, the sport's really well done. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the table tennis rallies are amazing now. They're always on TikTok, aren't they? Like, look at this amazing rally, and it's like, oh God, how do they get that back? So all that's really well done through CGI, but it's a real hustler chase movie. It's by one of the Safdie brothers. So you know, the Josh and Benny Safdie, they did one called Smashing Machine with The Rock when he was a wrestler this year, which was less successful. This one is a really cool one. They did a film together called Uncut Gems a couple of years ago with Adam
Sandler.
Oh,
I loved Uncut Gems. Oh. Right. This is Adam Sandler's great film, yeah.
Yeah, this is Uncut Gems, but with ping pong. And this has got that energy and that you're like, oh my God, but will this ever stop? Will the energy ever stop? But you don't really want it to. It's like a sort of never-ending ping pong rally of amazing bits of cinema. It's a properly cool movie that gets you out of your seat and makes you want to go to the cinema to it.
That's out now.
That's out now, Dom.
It's great, yeah. Okay, and then... again, just to look back on the year, give me a couple of films that I've definitely missed that we should have seen to look at.
I loved a Brazilian film called The Secret Agent,
Ooh,
which is a 70s set film. Okay. And it looks like the 70s. It's got, it's about, because in the 70s, Brazil was under fascist dictatorship. So there was a lot of disappeared people. There were a lot of people on the run from the authorities who were sort of in their bad books. We follow one such guy who returns home undercover with a beard. It's not a great cover, but it seems to get him around. And goes to see his family he hasn't seen in Recife, which is sort of on the Atlantic coast of Brazil. Yeah. And he goes back there. All of this director's films are always set in Recife. It's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of cool, but it's not Rio and it's not São Paulo. It's a kind of cool regional capital. And he's on the run and the authorities are kind of closing in on him, as are some hitmen who've been instructed to sort of bump him off because he's in hock to someone. And they all close in on him. And it's just these faces and characters and saturated colours of Brazil and sort of the sort of samba rhythms and the sort of technology of recording it on cassette recording and people doing early bugging. We talked about 70s films like The Conversation, which is...
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
This has got elements
of Conversation. Well, that was the 80s.
This has got De Palma written all over it.
Okay.
Blowout. So the sort of heroes of cinema are in this, but and yet it's all of its pieces. But I got a performance by Wagner Moura, who's a hot Brazilian actor. The people and the places, the characters, it's like a novel, this film. It's like a novelistic experience watching it, but it's gripping, brilliantly performed, and it looks absolutely fantastic. It looks like a 70s movie. They've done an amazing job with the sort of filters and the saturation, and I was completely transported. And every guy that turned up had this kind of swarthy skin and his face is like that. And like, and every character was just, you know, brilliant. The streets are teeming with people doing, it's set during Carnival, obviously. Yes, because, well, not because you've got a load of extras. I think you must shoot during Carnival. I was like, yeah, can't have got all those extras in there. And they're all dancing. But it's a great place for sort of, you know, hiding and running through sort of parades and kind of getting away from people who are trying to kill you.
Is that going to be easy to find?
I think it will be. I wish I had that date set for you.
I'll Google it, but I just, you know, I don't watch a lot of Brazilian cinema.
It might be on Mubi, which is a sort of posh streaming.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah. I thought it was terrific. And it's always good to have a Brazilian film on there. When they're good, the Brazilian films are absolutely, you know, top notch. And you just think of all their, I don't know, there's not a lot of football in this one, but I just kept thinking of, you know, those great Brazilian teams of the 70s bouncing the ball around, and it had that energy and that kind of colour that you get from Mexico 70. You know,
lovely. So, just a final film that we should maybe missed in 2025 that I'd like to see.
The film that I missed and caught up late is a film called Weapons.
Okay.
I thought this was amazing. It was a big hit in the summer. It is a horror, but it's about a class of kids in an American high school who all disappear one night without a trace, and except one kid who turns up at school the next morning. And where was the rest of your classmates? They've all left their houses and ran out of the doors at 2:17 in the morning.
There's a French TV series that has that, where all the kids in the valley disappear. I wonder if it's taken.
That's
from
right,
that.
The one with Clemence Posey, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've forgotten that one. I guess maybe the idea is from there, and then it tells the story a bit Rashomon-like from a few different perspectives. You see, it's very useful.
You have to. Yeah. I'm going to be dropping Rashomon everywhere now.
How are you doing today, Dom? Yeah, a bit Rashomon actually.
Rashomonista.
Yeah. There's a cream for that Rashomon. I thought it is funny. There's a great creation called Aunt Gladys Who Comes to Stay. Amazing performance from an actress called Amy Madigan. It's horror, but it's also extraordinarily cinematic. And I'm not a horror fan either. I was. This is when you do go and see it with people in the cinema, and people just go,
oh. So my wife's terrible at jumping. If I watch it with her...
It's not jump scares. Obviously, all horrors pretend they're going to do a jump scares. It isn't that. And then sometimes you just thought, oh, my God!
Really?
I'm
going to watch that.
I was out of my seat going, oh, my God!
Okay.
I wasn't expecting that. And some of it was just so brilliantly outrageous. It is a little... It might be an 18 certificate.
It's all right. I'm 18.
I warn you. Oh, yeah. Oh, you're good. You know, yeah. It's hard to tell on the radio.
That was Jason Solomons, film producer and critic.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. It's 1 minute past three. I am Dom Jolly and you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up on the programme today, Times columnist Alice Thompson joins me to give her review of the year. And John Robb, musician and author, joins me to discuss, among many other things, his book The Art of Darkness and All Things Goth. But first, the news of Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Some cross-channel rail services are resuming after an earlier power failure saw the Channel Tunnel closed and Eurostar cancel all of its London to Europe services for the day. It's called travel chaos for thousands trying to get away to celebrate the new year. Queues have been building at stations and on the roads leading to Folkestone and Dover as a result. Cathy Adams is senior commissioning editor for travel at the Times and says this is a bad time for such an issue.
Very busy time of year, yeah. People are, you know, coming home from family trips. They're going on New Year's Eve trips. Paris obviously is one of the most, accessible, easy destinations for us to get to from London. That means it's very popular. I mean, Eurostar usually deals with, I think it's 5,000 passengers an hour, and obviously this is nowhere near.
The shuttle services are gradually resuming, but there are warnings of six-hour delays at the Folkestone terminal. Getlink, which manages and operates the tunnel, said the problem affecting power supply to trains occurred last night. Energy Secretary Ed Miliband wants millions of homes to pay little or nothing for power, offering grants for solar panels, heat pumps and batteries. Up to £13 billion will be spent over the next 4 years to create zero-bill homes and cut carbon for 30 million households. Andrew Mountford, director of Net Zero Watch, says it will increase energy bills for most households.
Overall, there is no merit. We don't want ordinary people, poorer people, i.e. the people who can't afford the batteries, to have higher bills. Bills are already far, far too high. We have the highest electricity prices in the developed world, and Mr. Miliband's plans already are looking as if they're going to put them up by 30%.
Fresh questions are being asked about how much is kept hidden about the royal family. It's emerged that minutes from a meeting about Andrew Mountbatten's Windsor's trade missions were redacted from documents that have been made public. Actress Idris Elba and Olympic champions Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean are among the sirs and dames in the New Year's honours list. England's women's Euros defence is also recognised as manager Serena Wiegmann gets an honorary damehood. However, Rafe Hadel-Mankoo is co-editor of Burke's Peerage. He's criticised some of the awards.
It does seem as if the high-profile figures being awarded are being rewarded for failure. Charlotte Moore, who has now been given an OBE, this is a woman who was part of that terrible Gaza documentary. She was also tied up with the Donald Trump scandalous documentary.
A leading health expert says emergency departments across the UK are in big trouble with corridor care now normalised. Dr Ian Higginson from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine says patients are no longer surprised to be treated in corridors. But speaking to Times Radio, he also warned doctors can't deliver safe care there. The college estimates more than 16,000 deaths last year were linked to long waiting times for a hospital bed. Dr Higginson says the NHS needs a long-term solution.
The first thing to do would be to get the review into social care underway. That can has been kicked down the road a number of times now, and we rather than seeing delay after delay, we need to see that get underway and a proper solution to the way that we care for people in the community and the way that we support our social care sector, both of which are in crisis at the moment. So it's a lot of words but no action is what we see.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, welcome back for the final hour. This is me, Dom Jolly, filling in for Jane and Fee. Coming up this hour, I'll be speaking to Alice Thomas about her highlights and lowlights of 2025. And John Robb will be joining me later to discuss all things goth, music, and reflect on the past year in music. Don't forget to tell me your party horror stories. You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353. You can text 87222, start your message with the word Times, or you can email us studio@times.radio. All this week, I'm speaking to Times columnists, reflecting on the highlights and low points of 2025. And today, it's Alice Thompson, who's got plenty to say about Rachel Reeves's much-leaked, much-derided budget, the bacteria lurking in buffets, and why everyone should see Paddington the musical. I began by asking Alice to name two of her heroes of 2025.
Well, I'm going to give one I never thought I would, which is the King, actually, because I find it kind of extraordinary that he had cancer and had 400 solo, engagements that he did in the year. And he just kept going, and he's 77. And I didn't think he'd be a particularly good king, I have to say. I think it's quite hard coming after the Queen and the Queen Mum. And I think he's played a blinder, actually. I think he's shown that you can keep going. I think he's been sort of very charming. He hasn't meddled in government affairs, which I thought he would. There are no sort of scrawls all over government bills.
And in green ink.
Yeah, I quite like him. And actually, I think it's that he's sort of been solid and dependable at a time when you need someone to be. And I didn't think he would be that after the Queen died.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I think he was a bit looking for purpose as Prince of Wales. But I think now he's king, he's sort of settled. And yeah, I agree. I think he's done better. I thought his statement on cancer the other day was really good. So yeah, that's a good hero.
Yep, and actually he has got people to go and get checked out, and he's done it in an unpreachy way. And I think people at the moment, when it's quite volatile and everything's quite difficult, I think it's very good that he's not getting involved in world affairs. He was very polite to President Trump, but he's quite, you can see him raising an eyebrow, and I think he's doing it all quite well, actually.
Your second hero of 2025?
I might have to say Paddington, actually, because I think he's the other thing that's cheered me up this year.
Musical? You mean live musical Paddington?
Live musical Paddington. That he is just the gift that keeps giving, and that the song about Marmalade was fabulous. And
so you've seen it live, right?
I saw it live, and I would suggest going to it only because it makes you feel good about Britain. Actually, it was a bit like the 2012 Olympics, that you have this sense that, it's all those sort of bobbies on the beat, dancing in the rain, very mixed culturally. It's got all the big landmarks, the sort of Borough Market, the Natural History Museum. And I just thought, actually, after a year when it's all been pretty glum and pretty tough, it's quite nice to be reminded that you actually do, quite enjoy being in Britain, and that actually you are quite lucky to be here still.
Talk to me about live Paddington. Is it? It's not animatronic, is it? There's someone in there?
There's someone in there, and then there's the songs are sung by somebody else.
Right.
There's something kind of impressive about it because they work so well together as a team. And it is all kind of a bit schmaltzy, but I went with four nearly grown-up children who I thought would find the whole thing too much. And actually, they all really enjoyed it, as did pretty much everyone else in the audience. And it's not just for tourists. You feel that this is something that, the songs aren't, they're not sensational, but it's, it's just everything you like about London. And at the moment, I kind of think we're so rude about the capital, we're so worried about what's happening to Britain, that it's quite good just to be reminded occasionally that it's all quite entertaining.
Is it posh panto?
Yeah, I think you're being, I think, Dom, you probably said it, that actually, I find panto just too much. I don't really.
Me too.
Like,
I hate it.
I hate sort of that slapstick comedy, and it's not too slapstick.
Yeah. Okay. So that's highly recommended. And Paddington and the King, you've started big. So villains for 2025, there are quite a few to choose from. Who are your first?
I would have to say, I think, resident doctors, because I had one child who was in hospital, and it was during the first strike actually in November, and you just felt sorry for everyone else in the hospital because they were all running around trying to cover them. It was before the flu epidemic, but they were really squeezed, and I just thought, you've already got a 30% pay rise in the last 3 years, you're being paid pretty well, everyone else is struggling. A lot of people can't find jobs at the moment at all, and I know they've, it's a very grueling apprenticeship that they take, but there's so many other things they could have asked for. Actually, what they need is a more secure route into consultancy. I don't think they need any more money. They want to go back to 2008. I mean, we all want to go back to 2008. 2008 was like before everything went wrong. It was like a sort of perfect time when, everyone felt optimistic and you all thought the world was getting better.
Halcyon days. I think the last moment I remember everything I thought was all right was the Olympics, actually. And then, it's all downhill from there. Apart from the Elizabeth line, which I love, and Paddington.
Yes, I should have said that. That is my favourite line because that has halved my trips.
Yeah, I keep mentioning this, but it's just whenever I think Britain is broken, I think, no, the Elizabeth line is good.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, the other one is the super sewer. So I have written about that too.
What's
the
that?
The super sewer under London has been a triumph, and it came in on budget, on time. And it means that we now won't have
sewage sort of leaking up on the pavement.
Is this new Basil Get then, Basil Jet?
It is, and it's the only thing that's worked apart from the Elizabeth line.
Where is the? I totally missed the super sewer. Where is that?
Well, it goes the whole way underneath the Thames in London.
Oh, really? Oh, that's good. But that's too. You know, this is all being way too positive. We need another villain.
So the other villain, I think I have to say, I voted Labour and I think I've been deeply disappointed. And also I'm constantly apologising now for having voted Labour, which annoys me, because I did it not in a negative way, because I thought the Tories were awful. I actually thought they might do quite well. And I've interviewed all the shadow cabinet before they went into the cabinet and they have been a massive disappointment. So I don't exactly have buyer's remorse, but I thought the budget was incredibly badly leaked. I thought Rachel Reeves was too much of a victim, and I want them to be on the front foot now. I want them to be more optimistic. I want them to show what they can do. And at the moment, I feel that they are bashing businesses without actually understanding that businesses employ people, and what we need now is more employment.
Do you think it's a competency problem or a PR problem? Like a comms
both,
problem.
Which is even worse.
Yeah.
I think they're incompetent and their comms are terrible. And I think the combination of the two just means that everyone feels very despondent. And I just think they wanted some grown-ups they could trust now. And I went back and interviewed Rishi Sunak, actually. And there was a sense when I thought, oh, please come back. Because
oh, no.
At least he was honest about the mistakes he'd made. He was very sincere, actually, about what he'd got wrong. And I thought he had thought deeply about how you would right the country, whereas I feel Keir Starmer's just going from day to day.
This is like looking at Trump and then looking back at George W. Bush and thinking, you know what? He was
well,
all right.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about your highlights and low points of the year? Give me your highlights first.
Oh, the highlights. Well, I was going to do actually the surprises, which I thought were quite good.
Go ahead.
So I would say Justin Trudeau and Katy Perry was quite
oh, awesome. Yes. And Katy,
a good one.
And Katy Perry going into space. It was basically Katy Perry. Like.
Yeah. So all that was good. That was a surprise. That kept me amused.
Yeah.
Other surprises. Zach Polanski, I thought was interesting that a man who was really only known before for hypnotising women's breasts to make them larger.
That's a bit unfair, but go on.
Yeah, a bit unfair, yes. And he was maybe tricked into it by a tabloid.
Definitely.
But at the same time, I feel I was very surprised that he's done so well. So, you know, nearly 40% of the under-25s would support Greens now.
Not just the under-25s. I mean, I'm completely floating, disillusioned voter. And I don't know if I'd vote for them, but I certainly think you look at him and you think he speaks human. He's, I don't know, yeah, he's interesting.
Yeah, he's interesting. He's charming. I don't actually agree with him on the economy. I'm not sure he has an understanding of that either. And we have now got like 6-7 parties and none of them are really ones we want to vote for. So as you say, I mean, we're all looking around thinking we've got more and more choice and yet none of it's very appealing, which is surprising. I didn't think we'd have that at the beginning of the year. I didn't think we'd have quite so much choice and be quite so disaffected by what we have.
What about bad surprises?
Bad surprises. I think... I mean, the budget we knew because we knew it was coming in the end, but that
it was certainly not a surprise. That
wasn't a surprise at all. And then everyone said, oh, but it's OK. And that really annoyed me.
Yeah.
But that was probably when I was most cross as a columnist because I felt it wasn't OK. We knew it was bad. But then, you know, we always knew there wasn't going to be anything else in it. And I think that they misjudged it very much. And I think that we've got a problem with people. I think really with the people who work, which is who they said Labour what they were going to support, don't really feel very supported at the moment.
I don't think anyone feels that supported, but yeah.
No, and I think that's difficult. Well, I think also the two-child benefit cap being taken off, I think that really bothered me because I know a lot of millennials who are desperate to have children but can't afford to have any at all and are struggling because they can't pay, you know, rents on any larger apartments and they are, you know, having difficulties where they would live, what they would do, let alone have children. So that annoyed me that the government seemed quite so glib about just saying, well, certain parts of the population can have more children, but others can't.
That was Times columnist Alice Thompson. Coming up, she'll tell us how some people managed to slip through the cracks and become Prime Minister. It's 3:15. You're listening to Dom Jolly on Times Radio.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
I always enjoy going back to my childhood home to see Mum and Dad, but as they get older, the more and more guilty I would feel, you know, about leaving them on their own, especially in winter when it's so cold and miserable outside. I visit as often as I can with the rest of my family, but Mum and Dad really need someone around who can help them more regularly than we can. So thank goodness for Ellie. She's their care professional from home instead, and she actually lives with Mum and Dad, which means she can be there for them whenever they need her. It gives us real peace of mind. Mum and Dad really don't want to leave their home, and we don't want them to either. So living care from home instead was the perfect solution for us. It's been amazing. And Ellie's made such a difference to their lives too. They are so much happier, so much better in themselves. So now, whenever I visit them, they don't feel like Mum and Dad who need to be looked after. They feel like my parents again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
This is Times Radio.
We've been hearing from Times columnist Alice Thompson on her Heroes and Villains of 2025. King Charles and Paddington Bear were awarded gold stars, whilst resident doctors and the Labour Party were put on the naughty step. But it's easy for us to sit here and say what we did and didn't like from last year. So I asked Alice what she'd do if she were Prime Minister for a day.
I've always hated buffets and hot tubs. Those are the two things I'd ban, probably.
Oh, that's interesting. Why hot tubs? Are they a bacteria bath?
Yes, those are the two things I'm most worried about.
Really?
Like, please don't do this.
So both are for sort of bacteria reason.
Yes, both, I think, because I don't want anyone in the family getting a sick bug if I'm on holiday. They know that. Or chewing gum is the other one, probably.
Okay.
More seriously,
would that be on your first day in number 10? That would just be addictive.
Well, I might just slip that in, actually.
Yeah.
I might do a sugar tax at the same time because I'm quite like that. But I think on a more serious note, I would have round tip knives. So I've written quite a bit at the moment about...
That's interesting.
The issues of knife crime. And they know now when they've tested it that if people use more round tip knives, it would be much better. And part
that
of the
is genius. That's absolutely
well, actually,
genius.
You can use them for most cooking. And it's incredible what you can buy now. I mean, like all those zombie knives, which are meant to have been outlawed, you can still get. And then the cooking knives, the ones that people use most. And it's often domestic situations. And people just grab a knife in the heat of the moment or they take one with them. They're going out. And actually, round-tip knives are much less likely to do damage.
That is utter genius. Because, of course, I mean, the point of a knife ban is pointless because everyone's got a big knife in their kitchen drawer. And I'm thinking, have I ever stabbed something in my cooking that I'd miss? No. So that's genius.
Yes. And when I wrote the column, people did complain that they'd said, oh, but how do you know, what happens if I've got a fish or what happens if I've got, you know, an avocado? But you don't need a round, a pointed knife for that. And I think chefs maybe yes. But, you know, in domestic use, it's so easy in a fight or if a child thinks that they need to look after themselves to grab something from the kitchen. And it would be much better if you had more round tips. And you can buy them very easily, actually. And there are quite a lot of chef's rounded tips now that you can get.
I mean, have people proposed that seriously? What's the downside?
Yes, so Idris Elba has. Who else has? Quite a lot of the big names who are trying to combat knife crime have said this would be a good way of doing it. I haven't seen many chefs yet, but I think it wouldn't be difficult. The problem is we have so many knives in circulation. What you would do with the pointed knives. On the other hand, I wouldn't let anyone buy a knife from abroad. So, you know, a lot of the crimes that we've had recently have been from knife crimes, have been from people who bought knives from abroad, which are very easy to buy. And you can buy them, particularly they seem to come from Spain and they're termed hunting knives. But, you know, some of them have extraordinary names. And, you know, you just think, well, if you can buy that in the post, that must be wrong, surely.
But also, I mean, I don't think anyone actually going hunting with knives, and I don't know many people doing that are buying them on Amazon or ever. But yeah, look, I'd vote for you on that.
Well, actually, the other one is machetes. So you can legally buy machetes. And I'm fascinated because, I mean, I do quite a bit of gardening, but you don't need a machete. And
you're not Bear Grylls.
Yeah. Well, the amount of machetes that are being sold at the moment, they can't all be being used to cut down bamboos in people's gardens.
I don't think any of them are, to be honest. But yeah, okay, I'd vote for you on that. We've done this a little bit, but what did you least expect from 2025, apart from Katy Perry going into space and dating Justin Trudeau? Ooh. Are they still dating?
Yeah, that we don't know, do we?
No, because not since we saw them on the boat. My favourite story about the Katy Perry one was someone went past on a whale-watching boat, spotted them snogging on top of her yacht, and the guy said, I recognise them from Justin Trudeau's tattoo. And you think, who knows Justin Trudeau's tattoo? It was crazy, but I love that story. Anything else you didn't expect?
What else didn't I expect?
Liz Truss's YouTube channel. Have you watched that?
Yeah, that was pretty good. That was pretty good, I thought. Her comeback, I think we could call it.
Yeah. Have you watched it at all?
I haven't actually watched it. I have interviewed her quite a few times.
Have you? What's that like?
I mean, I always thought she was bonkers, but actually quite fun.
Right.
She is always up for a cocktail. She was quite feisty, but I was always stunned that anyone thought she could leave, particularly her own party. And I felt the same with Boris Johnson. I mean, I shared an office with Boris Johnson at the Telegraph, and it was the same, that he could be incredibly amusing. He could also be very down, but no one ever then thought of him as a prime minister.
So how do these people slip through in the end? This is the problem with letting the membership vote, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's far too serious for Christmas.
Is it? It's true.
I think they did it. That was completely wrong. They should never, ever have let the members choose, because we don't have a big membership of any of these parties. And the idea that the members or the unions or, you know, any small group of people is choosing who our leader is ridiculous, because actually, in the end, what you do is you vote for your MP, and then your MP
vote
for who they want as leader.
But also these people, you know, they work with these people. They know how bad they are or how good they are. So, yeah.
I thought in a weird way, Adolescence was something that was extraordinary, because that was the really big film of the year. And it was about something that should have been very depressing, but in fact it's had quite a good effect, I think, at getting boys to open up and talk about what their lives are like and how tough it is. And I think that there has been a change in that. I think we're being more sympathetic and more open now about what it's like to be a teenager. And I think before this year, we'd been very down on Gen Z and what was going on. And if I think we've probably begun to understand what the young are going through a bit more. And, you know, we'll get more into it. You know, we understand what rage bait is now. We understand all their, you know, aura farming, all those sort of words.
What would you like to see in 2026?
More optimism, I think.
Yeah.
On a literal sense, I want to go and see the film Hamnet.
That's good.
Maggie O'Farrell's my favourite.
So I don't know anything about that. I've just done a film review, actually, and I did it with Jason Solomons, and he gave me so many that I didn't get to Hamnet. Talk to me about that for a bit.
So Hamnet is one of my favourite books and plays, because it is about Shakespeare's wife, mainly, who was actually called Agnes, and it's called that in the book by Maggie O'Farrell. And it's about losing children, but also it's about the English language and it's just incredibly empathetic, and the film is meant to be, and it's meant to be a real weepy, which I quite like. And I don't really like, as you can tell from my rounded knife tips, I don't like stabbings and anything that starts with the sort of death of a woman on a beach. So I am looking forward to that.
That's good. So, okay. And anything else you'd like to see put sort of politically, news-wise, just more optimism? I'm with you on that.
Much more optimism. I want them to be more optimistic. I can't see, I think Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves might easily go, but I can't really see who else you would have, because Angela Rayner is not going to pull all the party together, nor is Wes Streeting. And Shabana Mahmood is very much being tipped by Tony Blair, but I'm not sure she's got it either. And I think that is the problem. It's sort of who actually can lead Britain now.
Wes Streeting? I can't see it.
No, you see, I can't see any of them. He can't lead the doctors, so...
Burnham, is he going to be the returning saviour? I like Andy Burnham, but...
Yeah, I mean, I like lots of them, but I just can't see who's going to make it. And the only thing I would say is I think we will see the return of the Tories, because you can see that happening already, that people are less embarrassed now about saying they quite like the sound of Kemi Badenoch.
I think that's interesting. After that conference speech, I think there was a corner turned a little bit. And yes, it's less ridiculous to support Tories, but are they going to be able to sort of chip stuff off reform?
Yes, I think Reform are becoming more flaky and they're seen to be more flaky. And I always thought this was going to happen, that individually they don't really add up. So, you know, Nigel Farage is a brilliant leader, but all the other people that he's leading, all, you know, they're a kind of very mixed bunch who've come from all over the place and haven't had much scrutiny. And I think they will get that. The same with the Greens. The surprise to me is always where the Liberal Democrats are, because they have 72 members and we never even notice them. But they don't ever seem to want to do that. I mean, I can see Ed Davey wants to go into, you know, I'm a celebrity, but he needs to get out there now. I mean, he needs to
I'm totally with you on that. I mean, I think most people are sort of in the middle somewhere and wanting something. And what are the Lib Dems doing? I'd love to support them. I couldn't tell you a policy, really, apart from PR, which maybe...
No, and they're the party that we should naturally be thinking of, because they unite all sides to a certain extent. You think, well, they're a little bit green and, you know, they're quite sensible and, you know, they've got, you know, actually, they've got, you know, quite a good group of MPs, actually. But we never really hear about them or see from them. And so I think that I'd quite like them to kind of, you know, succeed a bit more. But otherwise, I just want optimism. I want to feel better about everything.
That was Times columnist Alice Thompson on her Heroes and Villains of 2025. This is Dom Jolly, and I'm sitting in for both the Times at One and Jane and Fee all this week. And if you love Jane and Fee and you're missing them, why not give their podcast Off Air a go? There's a new episode every Monday to Thursday at around 6 p.m. and you can listen with your local podcast provider of choice. Recently, Fee spoke to Chris Van Tulleken about ultra-processed food and the industry behind it.
There are some real sources of hope. So we have, I think, a growing sense that the ultra-processed food industry isn't just similar to the tobacco industry. For a long time, it was the same industry. They were the same companies. The cigarette companies owned the big food companies that we know. And so I think we have a regulatory template that isn't identical, but we can use the same approaches. I think one of the real problems that we see in the UK is that there are financial conflicts of interest between every single institution that might regulate the ultra-processed food industry and the companies themselves, whether that's government guideline committees, scientific expert committees, academic journals, research units, our biggest food charities, our media communication centres. All of it is funded by the relatively small number of companies that feed us. So that was what we ended with tobacco first, is we said, if we're going to solve this problem, put warning labels on packs and effectively tax things, you need to speak to industry, you have to understand their limitations, and food is more complicated than tobacco. But you can't have industry holding your pen while you write policy.
So that was a clip from Jane and Fee's podcast, Off Air. If you're missing them this week, you can sate yourself by listening to that. Obviously, when I'm off air, that would be rude otherwise if you went straight to that. But you can download that and many, many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. As part of a digital subscription to The Times and Sunday Times, you get access to all the reporting, commentary and analysis from the world-class Times journalists. Plus, the app and website have daily interactive puzzles, features, interviews and more. You can also choose from a range of email newsletters and get access to offers, competitions and events. If you're already a subscriber, make sure you don't miss out on all the benefits, so head online and check it out. I'm not getting many messages from you at the moment about things that went wrong at parties. There was a flood of them at the beginning, and then you've stopped. And I'd like to say thank you so much for not doing that. I am, however, getting texts from my son himself saying, what are you talking about? Why are you telling everyone on the radio that I'm going to destroy the house? I didn't say that. I actually, in his defence, he's a good lad. He has very nice friends. I just was slightly worried, I have to say, when someone says, can we have the house for New Year's Eve? And you go, yeah, sure, I trust you. And then he goes, by the way, if there's anything you really value on the walls, take them down. I wouldn't have led with that, is what I'm saying. But I do honestly trust him. Jackson, if you're listening, which I hope you are, I know it's all going to be okay, isn't it? Please tell me that. Coming up, we'll be diving into the world of goth culture and, general music chat with musician and author John Robb. But first, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Channel Tunnel has partially reopened, but Eurostar is still warning passengers not to travel today. A power failure caused major disruption with passengers stranded on both sides. Getlink, which owns and operates the tunnel, said the problem affecting power supply to trains occurred last night. Cathy Adams is senior commissioning editor for travel at the Times and gave this advice.
They could technically get on a ferry, and I think the Port of Dover has said that they will try and get as many people on as possible. My personal advice would be just to sit and rebook for tomorrow, the day after, if you can possibly do that.
People are being warned any trains running will be subject to severe delays and possible last-minute cancellations. A man has been arrested after five people were assaulted with a weapon at a hospital. Merseyside police officers were called to the site in Newton Willows at around midday. Anthony Joshua's condition is being monitored in hospital following a fatal car crash in Nigeria. The British boxer was in a Lexus Jeep when it hit a parked truck yesterday. Two of his friends died. And a pedestrian has died after being hit by a car in Kent and carried on top of it for possibly a mile. Two men have been arrested. The man in his 80s was struck in Gillingham yesterday. And Beyonce has been declared a billionaire. Forbes says she's the fifth musician to ever hit that milestone. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Welcome across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Welcome back again, double time. We're going to talk about music and, very cool little trail there. Coming up for the next half an hour or so, I do this thing in Cheltenham once a month. It's a live show in which I don't announce who my guests are, and I always try and get people to talk that I think are particularly interesting. And my next guest, or the guest that's going to be turning up in the next half hour, was on that show recently. He's a guy called John Robb. He's a very interesting man. He's been in and around the British music scene for the best part of 50 years. After cutting his teeth as the front man of the post-punk band The Membranes, Robb went on to spearhead a number of other bands, including the punk rock outfit Goldblade. He's also become one of the country's best music journalists, having written books about punk, Oasis, and the Stone Roses. And one of his more recent books looks at a topic close to my heart, which is goth culture. The Art of Darkness, he called the book, which I do think is one of the greatest titles ever. And I'm very jealous because I could have nicked that. And that traces the roots of goth all the way back to the fall of Rome up to where we are now. And I'm delighted to say that John joins me now. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm all right, Tom. Yeah.
Good stuff.
2,000 years.
2,000 years.
I'm going to get all that in 2 minutes.
We're going to talk about... No, you've got lots of time here. We've got about 20 minutes, I think, so we can chat about all stuff. Now, I got you on because when I was doing this week's show and the team, sort of Fee and Jane's team, sent me a thing saying, what sort of things are you interested in? So I sent them a very strange list of things like Tintin, Belgium, dark tourism. And I just said goths, because I mean, you know that I'm very into the whole goth world. And then bang, they book you straight away, which I'm incredibly happy. You were on my speakeasy just a month ago where we got to talk about stuff. And I think I don't want to just talk about goth culture, but let's start with that. You wrote the book, The Art of Darkness, about the roots of goth. And goths really have a bit of a, I think they're the butt of comedy sometimes. Talk to me a little bit about, when I was looking at, into goths, I couldn't even really work out where goths started. It, to me, it was around 1981 in the post-punk moments, but you trace it all the way back. So give me a sort of potted history of goths.
Well, yeah, of course, it's a very complex history. That's why I ended with a book with about 600 pages in it.
Yeah.
So I think if you really do unpack it all the way back to the beginning where the word came from, you have to start with the Visigoths sacking Rome in 411. So that's where the idea of these dark forces impinging on Europe come from. And then that word kind of floats around all the way through the next few centuries, through the Middle Ages, Gothic architecture, Gothic painting. And then we zoom up to pop culture, and the first band to be called Goth or Gothic was The Doors, and their first gig in New York City in 1967. So it's a complex issue, but interesting one. And I figured
that's interesting because
goth.
When I talk about goths, you know, I always think, is it The Cure, the Sisters of Mercy, Bauhaus? But you say The Doors were the first acknowledged goth band.
First acknowledged band to be goth or gothic, in a sense. I mean, I don't think The Doors have ever claimed to be a goth band, but then all the bands claim not to be goth bands. There isn't a goth band in existence is happy with the term. They all really despise the term.
Why, though? I find that really strange.
Because when we initially started a conversation, you said the goths are the butt of a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of a joke term for a scene that didn't really exist, you know, so it was coined, well, there's a few people claim where it's coined, but it was used to laugh at these kind of groups that were coming in that were sort of not that hip in the music papers. So that nobody wanted to be laughed at. Who wants to be laughed at in a band? So it became a sort of joke term. But then, ironically, it's a good term. It kind of fits, doesn't it? So years later, two, three, four generations later, people are quite happy with the term. I don't think anybody takes terminology quite seriously. I understand if you're in a band, you don't want to get boxed into a scene that you weren't actually in the first place, do you? I mean, why would Susie want to be in the goth scene when she's been doing that sort of stuff for 6 years before the term was even coined, you know? I mean, these are people making art on their own individual violation, aren't they? They're not making art to be part of a scene, really. So I get that one as well.
I mean, Susie is interesting. Because I'd always put Susie down and Susie and the Banshees as punk rather than goth. But for instance, if there's someone I really would... You know, I think for a layman, they'd think who's the king goth. You'd probably think Robert Smith from The Cure. I did a documentary on goth and rang him up to see whether he'd do it, and he said, "No, I'm not a goth." So he's a goth denier. But who do you think? Who are the main? What defines goth music? I suppose.
Well, I suppose loosely defining it, it's got a melancholia to it, but you could dance to it as well. I mean, it's not a load of people moping around. I mean, goth culture really caught fire in clubs. It was the first kind. They were called alternative clubs. I mean, anybody my age will remember that's what everything was called. And it wasn't called golf clubs. It was kind of clubs in towns that never had clubs before, where they had like alternative music, where people started dressing in darker and darker clothes. So it wasn't like an overnight thing where everybody suddenly became this big new sensation. And it kind of also percolated out of unexpected places. So the first golf club, of course, is in Leeds. It's the Fono. And then all those sort of Yorkshire towns and northern towns we don't have any scene at all. Kind of these cool spaces where a load of freaks can hang out, always the best kind of places. So, I mean, Robert Smith is not a goth at all, is he?
I would say the first three.
It's complicated.
The first three albums of The Cure are definitely goth. And his look is definitely goth. But then obviously, you know, he goes on to he changes so much.
I don't want to be nitpicking, but it's actually album 2, 3, 4. The first album.
Sorry, you're quite correct. Yeah.
I mean, you knew that. It's just because we're on the radio. We have to do it dead quick. But the first album is more, it's kind of John Peel, left field underground pop in a weird way. It's like Buzzcocks or something, isn't it? So then they went darker. Joy Division was an influence. But they very much made it their own thing. I think his image was because he joined the Banshees, didn't he? So he joined the Banshees when they split and they got him in. And he started to look more and more like a Banshee. I don't think you could be in a band like Susie Banshees and not they looked amazing, and that's definitely going to be getting to your DNA. And Robert did a great version of it. To this day, he looks amazing. I love the way, at 65 years old, he still puts his lipstick on.
Yeah.
To me, that's a victory. That's a way to lead your life, isn't it?
I once had him doing a cameo on a documentary I made, and I hadn't seen him around for about 5 years, and I wondered whether maybe he'd changed and cut all his hair off and everything, and I didn't really want to ask, and in the end, I just said... I sent to his management, will Robert need a makeup artist? And they said, no, he'll do his own. I thought, great, he's going to turn up as his, which is fantastic. But let's, goths are interesting as well because, you know, there's a sort of English type of goth. There's always a hot goth. Like you go to any Mediterranean country or any beach resort, there's always one lonely, the only goth in the village standing, staring at the sea with his makeup running down. And then in America, goths became something a little... darker, if you like, even more. I mean, the people that did Columbine were described as goths, Marilyn Manson. What's the difference, would you say, between an English goth and an American goth?
I think an English goth grew out of post-punk and glam rock as well, British glam rock, which is quite different from American glam rock. You know, there's a big difference between David Bowie and Kiss, and one's really artful and one isn't, so I'll leave that up to the listeners to work out. So the Americans seems heavier, wasn't it? They're more, there's metal. Metal's always, for years and years and years, has always been like the core of American culture, whereas here it was more fringe, wasn't it, in a sense? It was more... And it's about the clothes here as well. That's always been really important. So there is a difference. The roots are different, but there's a lot of crossovers. I think the American scene was later as well, and it crossed over into metal, into other sort of forms of music. So Marilyn Manson, he's sort of goth and isn't, isn't he? Like everybody in this scene. And every time you explain it, you have to pre-say every sentence with that phrase.
Yeah.
No, they are goth. No, they aren't. So a lot of people in the goth scene would not see Marilyn Manson as being goth, but I think Marilyn Manson was into goth, but he's also into a lot of industrial music, and also he has a metal thing going on, Manson stuff as well, you know. So it was all mixed together. But of course, as the decades go on, nothing stays the same and nothing should stay the same. The culture should change,
yeah,
be crisscrossed with other influences, shouldn't it? I mean, what makes goth now? You know, but it's still a music scene that hooks around goth, but a lot of it's electronic music. A lot of goth influences now you see on social media are people just wear goth clothes and there's no music on it at all. So there's an Instagram sort of goth influencer, you know, and they never have music on their page, which I think is quite cool in a way because it takes you back to the medieval times when goth was art, paintings, just back, a modern version, isn't it?
Back to basic goths. I think there's a board game that needs to come out called Goth or Not, which would be absolutely fantastic. Moving away from goth for a second... You've written a book about Oasis. You're a Manchester native. I think we can safely say that Oasis are not goth, but it was a massive year for Oasis. They returned to the stage for the first time. What was that like to see? Did they hold up? Was it the triumph we think it is?
Firstly, I mean, obviously Oasis aren't goth at all by any measure, but Noel Gallagher does like some of the bands in that scene as well. I mean, like anybody... He's really good at music, listens to a lot of different music, so lots of different scenes, and goes way beyond genre, you know. So he's a fan of the Chameleons, he's a fan of The Cure. I mean, again, not strictly what goth fans, whatever. People have those records, their collections in the goth scene. So, and Joy Division as well, he's a big fan of Joy Division. So, yeah, I went to the gigs, I went to three of them, went to two Heaton Parks and one Wembley, and they're amazing. They never sounded that good. Three guitars, brilliant wall of sound. Noel plays his solos like he should, because he didn't always play them back in the day. And Liam's voice is great. And they are great songs. I know it's strictly an exercise in nostalgia, but sometimes nostalgia is... I was reading a quote the other day. Did somebody say something to one of the Sex Pistols? Why don't you do any new music? I said, it sent it to Rotten, didn't they, when the first reformed? And he said, what's wrong with the first album? You know, sometimes you made the perfect statement, don't you? There's no... There's no point in making another one. Like the Rolling Stones keep trying to make a good record and they just can't, can they?
It is absolutely true. Do you think we got a bit distracted by the whole sibling drama and the music took a bit of a back seat? Because I think the reunion was so powerful and such a sort of an event. Was it people just remembering, particularly those first two albums, what was so special about them?
I think there's definitely a lot. Yeah, there's an element of that in there. But the audience wasn't just a lot of people in their 50s. You know, there was gigs I went to, there's loads of teenagers there as well. I think great pop music goes through generations. You know, like the Beatles that are as omnipresent now as they were in the 1960s. And in a sense, I mean, probably one or two levels down, Oasis are the same, aren't they? So the music to an 18-year-old won't sound dated. It'll just sound good. They'll the universal themes, people connect with them, don't they? And I think that goes beyond any level of analysis, criticism, whatever. It's just music that works on its own. So I think that's important. I think we did get distracted by the sibling rivalry, even though it was entertaining, wasn't it? I mean, they're both really funny in completely different ways. So when it's played out on social media, it's funny. But you kind of think, oh, come on, your brothers just get on with each other. And they do now, which is quite... It's in a year of, like, really miserable, relentless miseries stories, isn't it? Like, every news story is horrible, isn't it? It was actually a nice story to have in the news, wasn't it? Look, two people actually, in this planet, two people made up.
Yeah.
That's not a headline you get nowadays, is it?
It is true. We are in a completely polarised, divided thing, and those were two people that came back together. I have this theory about brothers in bands, because there's a certain tension that you get between siblings, and one of the reasons, you know, they both went off and did solo stuff. He did BDI and Noel Gallagher's band, but I just, you know, they didn't reach the heights of Oasis. Do you think there is something about that peculiar tension in a band? Sometimes it's not siblings, sometimes it's between the two sort of supposed leaders of a band, if there's a bit of a rivalry that kind of makes people go above and beyond.
Of course, but people are always fighting over the spotlight. And in rock bands, rock and roll bands, it's usually the lead guitar player and the singer, in it. Where, I mean, but it's mad, isn't it? Because they both bring something unique into that space. But it's, to get that big, to get yourself on stage, to get the drive to do it, you need some level of ego. And if there's two egos in a room, they are going to rub up, aren't they? You know, and having an ego is not a bad thing, because you need that. The ego drives the band along. If you could back the ego up with talent, then it's perfect, isn't it? But with them, what you have to remember, the other thing with brothers is, especially with Noel and Liam, they grew up in a council house in Burnage, and they both shared a bedroom for 16 years, a small bedroom. And then they got in a band and shared 16 years on a tour bus. That's 32 years.
Yeah, they needed a break.
You know? You know, I mean, nobody has to do that, do they, in the world? You know, like, you know, anybody listen to this, you go to work with people, then you go home and see them after the weekends. But the band, you're stuck together forever and ever. It's hard. I actually think now, looking back on it after writing the book, they actually got on better than most people do, being stuck in a very small space.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the weird comparisons I always think about when I think of Oasis is Elton John and Bernie Taupin. You so think of Elton John and those lyrics, and yet they're being written by a straight man, by Bernie Taupin, you know, writing lyrics that Elton John then kind of produces. And similarly, you had the kind of swagger of Liam and the kind of vulnerability, I think, of Noel writing the songs. How much of that is true, do you think?
I think that's a really brilliant observation, because...
Hooray!
With Oasis, of course, the swagger. I thought that was a Mancunian kind of expression, but it's actually Shakespeare came at the word swagger. There's an interesting little aside for you. Yeah, but some people thought song for the swagger, and they were good at that, you know, and it's uplifting. But also, and this is the sucker punch to them, is that vulnerability. I think that's something. They can sing about vulnerability and make a vulnerability in a way that blokes who can't talk about vulnerability can just nod along to a song and feel it. If you know what I mean,
100%.
You could dancing to vulnerability.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which is what rock and roll's for. Yeah,
it's incredible. I've seen sort of heavily tattooed, quite aggressive looking men at elbow gigs weeping at songs, which is I think that's the importance. Yeah, it's the importance of this sort of music.
It's our safe space, isn't it? As blokes of a certain age, you know, we can't tell our mates any of that stuff, but we can sort of nod to it in the song. And we all know what you mean, but we can't actually say it, can we? So that's how it works, isn't it, for years. It's better now because people are a bit more in touch with those feelings, and my generation certainly wasn't.
I agree with that. Now, with Oasis, just to finish with Oasis, is that it? It's this massive, massive, mega world tour, and then are they just going to go off into the sunset? Are they going to... They haven't even hinted at a new album, have they?
Well, they've given nothing away. I mean, lots of people asked Liam on Twitter, what are they going to do Nebworth in 26? And he's saying no.
Yeah.
But nobody asked if they're doing it in 27, did they? So perhaps that could be a possibility. I think it's difficult doing a record, because if you make the best record of all time, people will be disappointed by it, won't they? It wasn't as good as when I was 16 and you know, and I felt like I was going to live forever. And that music soundtrack to, you can't ever feel that good again in your life. It's the best time of your life. But an older record is very difficult to match those kind of feelings. But saying that, I mean, Noel's very smart. He's the smartest operator in the band I've ever met. And he's probably too smart to make him the record that everyone will go, that's disappointed. But on the other hand, I just go, go on, Noel, dare to do it. You know, to get into that little tiny space where only the Beatles, about two of the bands exist, that little room right at the top of rock and roll, and they're very close, they're sort of knocking on the door to get through that door, you've got to dare to make that record. And then all they need, right, is five classic sing-along songs, two acoustics from Roll and two from Liam. That's all. Nothing. That's easy, isn't it?
And nothing from Bonehead.
No. Bonehead's a key constituent part of the band, you know. That's why the tour was so good. You know, he's the heart and soul, like Manny was in the Roses, the heart and soul of the band, you know, the one that everyone loves and can identify with.
And that's actually exactly where I wanted to go next, actually, because you wrote a book on the Stone Roses, and we wanted to look at people that passed away this year. And obviously, one of the big ones was Manny, bassist from both Primal Scream and Stone Roses. Tell us a bit about Manny, how important he was.
Well, I mean, for a start, and this is the most important thing when you talk about people like this, he was actually a really beautiful human being. And I think all the stuff on Facebook that I saw about him after he died, there's just people saying, I met him in a greengrocer's. He was just there, and I went to take his picture, and he was great, and he's a really good laugh, and he took my picture. And
I totally. So
there's hundreds of people saying that, and I think, isn't that the best epitaph? You know, on your gravestone or whatever.
I met him in a pub.
You were just a really good bloke.
I met him in the pub, and he was just amazing. Just really nice guy. But what, I mean, Stone Roses were a seminal band. How rare is it that people can jump into two great bands? So Stone Roses and Primal Scream.
Like I always said, it's the greatest free transfer in rock and roll history, isn't it? It was so perfect, wasn't it? Because the Roses used to go and watch Primal Scream, and there's a lot of overlaps, you know, and they, you know, there's an influence from one band to the other, and they're kind of similar in a lot of ways. So it was perfect when he went to them. And I think when he joined them, and Primal's always good, and when he joined them, he added something to it, didn't he? You know, and that, you know, the first Roses album, he doesn't actually write the bass lines on it, but the way he plays them made a difference. You know, it's the nuances he added to it that gave the band the swing. But by the time he gets to Primals and he's doing most of the bass lines, then it's different, isn't it? And they're making those really dark, weird underground records and getting to number one in the charts. You know, he liked a lot of that stuff. You know, we can go all the way back to the Art of Darkness. He liked a lot of those bands as well, you know, a lot of punk bands. He was always messaging me on Facebook going, when there's some punk bands coming through Manchester, and do you know what league are playing next week? Do you want to go?
Anti-Nowhere League. I've not heard the Anti-Nowhere League for a long time, but yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Those guys are still going, you know, but he loved all that stuff, you know. It's like any proper music fan. You don't have any filter. You just love all kinds of music, you know.
And what a...
So
what
it's not like cool or... There's no such thing as cool or uncool music, is there?
It's just music. And what a great memorial service he had. Who turned up to carry the coffin for him, and Manny?
Well, most people there were the Roses carrying it. And
Liam was there, was
Bobby
he?
Did. Ian Brown, the greatest eulogy I've ever seen. It was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he's written great words and lyrics in his career, but his eulogy at Manny's funeral, to me, is the pinnacle of his career. It was a beautiful, poetic, poignant, funny, touching speech. It was absolutely fantastic. You know, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. You know, this is Manchester. You don't do public displays of emotion. You feel it, but you don't let it out. And it's like, but it was a really brilliant speech. And you're watching Three Roses. You know, they don't always get on. You know, carrying the coffin out with something that other dudes, and the man is in the coffin. You think, oh God, that's all four of them for the last time, isn't it? You know, and that band was such an important band, and it means so much in Manchester as well. And, you know, it's maybe they are the most, I mean, how many important bands come out of Manchester? I mean, this is another pub I'm going to go on forever. But, you know, like, if you ask Noel or Liam, they'll tell you that's the number one band, you know, that was the greatest band. You had to be at those gigs in the early days. You never felt the love in the room. I never felt in any of the bands. You know, the Blackpool gig when the Roses came on the stage, it was off the scale, you know, all those gigs. It was just, it felt like a youth quake. I always wondered what it would be like to to go to a gig in the moment when culture changed overnight, and Blackpool Empress Ballrooms like that, it's like, wow, this must be like seeing the Beatles when they broke through, or the Stones.
I've always wondered that.
Everyone's trousers, hair and music changes.
I've always wondered that, but are you aware at that very moment that you're there, or do you kind of realise it, oh my gosh, I was there, was it incredible? Let's just quickly, as we're running out of time.
I was totally aware.
You were aware. Yeah. As we're just running out of time.
I totally felt it, yeah. That's my job, isn't it?
I know it is. I suppose there's a goth element to this. We obviously lost Ozzy Osbourne this year as well.
Yeah.
Did you go to the sort of farewell concert where he bowed out almost perfectly, didn't he, with a sort of a great concert where he appeared at? Was it a good concert? Is Young Blood good? So many questions.
I didn't go to concert. I was doing stuff that night, but the early Sabbath records are amazing records, and they started off one of the most enduring musical genres of all time. It's funny when he died, because I had to do loads of radio on it. And most of the people from these local radio stations are asking me about Ozzy Osbourne, this TV personality. I was going, no, he's one of the greatest singers in British rock and roll history. He's a really good singer with a really great voice in one of the most important bands this country's ever produced. And I thought, let's celebrate his artistry, not his clowning around on television, you know, because they just always do this, don't they? Just try and turn people into a caricature. And I want to celebrate the art. So I did. So I probably did their heads in a bit. So, and Youngblood, I think Youngblood's a really great rock star. He looks better than he sounds, but his music's catching up with every record.
That's bang on. He looks the part, but I'm not quite sure whether his music's there yet. Listen, John, I could talk to you for hours about this. You're going to have to come back on my speakeasy. But John Robb, your memoir is coming out in May 2026. Your book on goth, The Art of Darkness, is literally the war and peace of the goth movement. It's 600 pages. John, thank you so much for coming
on
there.
Thank you, Tom.
Really appreciate it.
All right, nice one.
Thanks. That was John Robb there, ex-frontman of the post-punk band The Membranes and sort of, I don't know, goth archivist. Absolutely fantastic. Sorry if you're not into goth, but, you know, you just need to know sometimes about this sort of stuff.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Simplify making tax digital for income tax with Xero. If you're a sole trader or landlord, you'll need to use HMRC-recognized software like Xero to track your income and expenses, share quarterly updates, and submit your final tax return. Xero accounting software gives you a clear view of your financial picture. And with each quarterly update, you'll see your estimated tax bill, helping to avoid those nasty year-end surprises. Simply snap, scan, and sort receipts on your phone and on the go, so your records stay organized all year round, putting an end to the January panic and the piles of paperwork. With Xero, go beyond compliance and gain better control of your business finances. Your records stay up to date automatically, invoicing and payments run online, and a better view of your numbers helps you plan ahead. Less scramble at year end, more confidence all year. Change the way you see making tax digital with Xero. Search MTD Ready.
This is Times Radio.
Well, that's nearly it, but Ollie Mann has come in early again. He's not going to tell me again about more Disney. Ollie, we were just talking about goth there, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know where you stand on goth, but a goth musical, I think that could be the sweet spot if we're in Venezuela. We're starting to, like, get it all.
I think you're describing The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Really? Do you think?
Well, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think there was an Edward Scissorhands ballet.
Yes. Edward Scissorhands, I always felt it was a bit caricature. Ballet, God, I'm not going to see. You just ruined it, just as it was all going well.
I must say.
There's no way I'm doing... I'm a Philistine. I'm a complete Philistine. You're probably
I draw the line at ballet. I didn't go and see that.
Did you not?
No, but I like the idea of a goth musical. Beetlejuice, of course. All the Tim Burton stuff. There is a Beetlejuice musical opening in the West End.
Tim Burton is the...
That is a goth musical.
He's the great filmmaker of goths, isn't he?
He is. Yeah,
anyway. But look, I'm waffling because I'm having to fill a minute, but I'm always very pleased to speak to you, Ollie, and I hope you have a very good drive show. That's it from me today. Thanks to my team, Maddie, Eve, Hannah, Joseph, my technical operator, Robin. I will be back tomorrow from 1 p.m. Up next, well, it's Ollie Mann, isn't it? In for John Pienaar.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
It's 4 o'clock. You're listening to Ollie Mann here on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: the Channel Tunnel has partially reopened, but Eurostar are still warning passengers not to travel today. And Ukraine's European allies have held discussions following President Zelensky's weekend talks with Donald Trump. Coming up, I'll speak to someone who's had a tumultuous journey navigating the Channel today. It sounds horrendous. Plus, with union support for Labour in the spotlight, we'll take a look at the political party's historical relationship with trades unions. And later on, I'll speak to the man who's been honoured in the New Year's Honours list for services to weightlifting.
This is Times Radio.
But first, the latest headlines with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Train services through the Channel Tunnel linking Britain and continental Europe are gradually resuming. A power failure affected one of the busiest international rail corridors at the height of the New Year travel season. Both Le Shuttle, which carries vehicles through the tunnel, and Eurostar services have gradually resumed, but the passenger line Eurostar is strongly advising passengers to postpone their journeys. Teacher Alison Raby says their options are limited.
We've arranged a day trip to go to a theme park just on the other side of Belgium, and we were supposed to leave at 8:24 this morning, and it is now 12:32, so our train back is at 7 o'clock this evening, so there's no point in us going now, and we're stuck in the traffic with everybody. And we can't leave because technically we're in France, so we're stuck.
European and Canadian leaders held a discussion this morning to discuss Ukraine following President Zelensky's talks with Donald Trump over the weekend. It comes after Zelensky denied allegations made by Russia that Ukraine launched a drone attack on one of President Putin's residences. Following the drone strikes, a Kremlin spokesperson said the response will be to toughen the negotiating position of the Russian Federation. Sir Tony Brenton, former British ambassador to Moscow, told Times Radio what he made of it all.
The latest accusation has turned up this morning. It's slightly bizarre. It's a big accusation to make, and it obviously got under Trump's skin a bit when Putin said to Trump that this is what the Ukrainians had done. Do I believe it? Half and half. On the one hand, the Russians do make things up. On the other hand, the Ukrainians do launch off-the-wall operations, like, for example, blowing up the Nord Stream 2 oil pipeline, and then deny them fervently afterwards.
The Foreign Office has launched an internal inquiry after failing to spot social media posts by British Egyptian activist Alaa Abdel Fattah, which included calls for violence against Zionists. El Fattah has apologised for some posts, claiming others were misrepresented. Aubrey Allegretti is the Times' chief political correspondent and has been looking into further social media posts over the past 24 hours.
He'd liked a comment on Facebook, which stipulated that there had been a campaign launched against him by, in the words of this poster, Zionists. The sort of revelation of that cast questions about the extent to which his apology is really particularly sort of contrite and heartfelt, because that was certainly how it was being portrayed by Downing Street yesterday, calling it a fulsome apology and effectively saying there is no more that the government needs to do here. He's been welcomed home and that's it.
Anthony Joshua's condition is being monitored in hospital following a fatal car crash in Nigeria. The British boxer was in a Lexus Jeep when it hit a parked truck yesterday. Two of his friends died. The government's denied that redacted files released to the National Archives are part of a cover-up. There's been criticism that minutes of a meeting relating to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor have been censored. And Serena Wiegmann says she never expected the respect and warmth shown by English fans after being made an honorary dame in the New Year's Honours list. It's after her Lioness side won back-to-back Women's Euros. Actor Idris Elba and TV writer Roy Clark are now Sirs. 92-year-old Betty Brown, the oldest victim of the post office IT scandal, has received an OBE.
When I went and said to my husband, we're £3,000 short, my husband had left the cancer clinic, he just suddenly went absolutely white as a sheet. That is what upset all the treatment.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Times Radio Drive.
Hello, happy New Year's Eve. Ollie Mann here, in for John, all this week through until 7pm here on Times Radio Drive. And before we proceed, can I just start by shouting out to my in-laws, Anne and John? I want to do that because my wife is also working today, so we needed a childcare solution. Most holiday camps are closed. I didn't realise. Apparently after Christmas, people don't need childcare between Christmas and New Year. What's that? So the grandparents stepped in, and I know they're listening. So guys, thank you. Help yourself to a bottle from our wine fridge. You will need it after 6 hours looking after my children. Coming up, what is President Trump getting up to in Venezuela? It has emerged today that last week the CIA conducted a drone strike on a dock which was purportedly being used by an organised crime gang for transporting narcotics. Similar story to what we've heard before when Trump's talked about bombing those boats. But this is a big deal because despite those previous strikes on boats which were allegedly used for drugs trafficking, this is the first known US operation inside Venezuela. Wasn't approved by Congress. We haven't seen any evidence that it was being used for drugs. And of course, there is no death penalty for drug trafficking within the United States. So what's the justification for that if they had killed somebody, which they didn't? I'll be talking to an American general about that after five. And coming up later this hour, have you been using the internet to self-diagnose? Dom touched on this a little bit earlier as well. Dietitians warning today that too many people use social media and home testing kits these days to self-diagnose food intolerances. And as a result, they're cutting out dairy, they're cutting out wheat. It's unnecessary. They're depriving themselves of vital nutrients. They haven't sought the opinion of a medical specialist first. Is that you? Have you self-diagnosed? Perhaps you're perfectly happy with the results of having done so. You didn't have to go and see a GP. We were only saying yesterday how long the wait can be in the NHS these days. You just found the answer with Dr. Google or ChatGPT, and that worked for you. Or perhaps you've seen someone in your family become convinced they are, insert label of medical condition here, based purely on internet research, and you're worried for their health. Let me know. 87222. Start your message with the word Times. On social media, we are at Times Radio. You can email us studio@times.radio, and you can send WhatsApp messages, pictures and voice notes to 033-003-2353. And of course, I'll welcome your views on everything throughout the show, including our first story, which is about the severe disruption on Eurostar services there has been today between London and Europe after a major power failure in the Channel Tunnel. If you've been affected by that, let me know. 87222, start your message with the word Times. The tunnel has now partially reopened, thankfully, but passengers are still being strongly advised not to travel. London St Pancras and Paris-Gare du Nord look absolutely horrendous from the photos that I've seen on social media. We're going to speak to someone who's been trapped up in it all next. But first, Cathy Adams from the Times Travel Desk is here. Hi there, Cathy.
Hello.
I presume you weren't due to be travelling today, so this has not been as bad as it could have been for you.
No, thankfully, I'm not in France today. I'm very much in London, although I was coming back from Benidorm yesterday into Gatwick Airport. And the point is that it's a very busy time of year to be travelling. You know,